Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, my fellow Westorians. Welcome back to our House of the Dragon coverage. Remember that Monday episodes at 6 o'clock Eastern are spoiler-free. Spoiler-filled episodes are Saturdays at 3. Last week for our spoiler episode, we had poor Quentin. That went excellently. We made some good predictions for this one. A few things we got wrong, but mostly we got pretty close. And it was a really fun episode. Next week, we're going to be with Radio Westeros for our guest. And you may notice that rather than on another screen in another place, sitting beside me, as in days of old, is Sean himself. How's it going, buddy?
It's going great. It's been a fun experience to be here again after a few years.
Yeah,
DragonCon weekend prompted all this. So.
Yeah, we had our screening of episode 3. We also watched episode 2, rewatched it at a local theater called The Plaza, and it was a lot of fun. We had about maybe 100 people there, and it was a lot of fun to see that on the big screen. So, yeah, DragonCon festivities here in Atlanta, good times, and I hope if you were one of the people that was here, you had a good time as well, and I hope you made it to the screening. Thanks to those people who did come. Thanks to Ashea for running it. She did the majority of the work, and it turned out great.
Yeah, it was so much fun to get to see people's reactions during the episode. It was very fun.
It was pretty much the only other time we had experience like that was at Balticon. Well, not one other time. Balticon and Ice and Fire Con, we both had group watches that were really exciting. And the live Ice and FireCon was also episode 3 and also a battle episode. The long night episode. At Balticon, we watched, the Burn the Mall episode of Game of Thrones where Bran meets Cold Hands.
Didn't we also see a couple premiere episodes, like in a theater, like the first episode?
Yeah, we did. Those were in local shows. Those weren't with like big groups of friends, but yeah, you're right. Those count as well. So watch our synopsis videos before each live stream, except this week. The audio version is up already, but because of Dragon Con and the festivities, we weren't able to get the synopsis video up before, but it will be up still, and we'll continue those throughout the season. Also, make sure to check out our interview with George R. Martin and our interview with Ryan Condal. some of the things both of them said are pretty relevant for this episode, and I'm sure that will remain true off and on, if not mostly on, rarely off, for the rest of the season. We'll start with our usual 3x3 to break it in a little slowly, a little bantery topic where we pick our favorite things. Last week, we, as usual, we have our Facebook poll. The top pick for best performer was Millie Alcock, who got 52% of the vote, which blew everyone else out of the water by a mile. No one else even got 10%. So she absolutely dominated that poll. Join the discussion there on Facebook as well as on Discord. We also post occasionally on Twitter. You can also reach out to us on email if you prefer at westeroshistory.com, or if you're a member on Patreon, you can send us a message there. So, highlight performance. I'll start. I'm going to say Patty Considine this time. George R. Martin really praised Patty ahead of the release of the season because he, of course, saw some of the episodes in advance. And this was the highlight performer for him based on his comments. He didn't come out and say that, but he certainly talked a lot about Patty. And I definitely see what he was talking about. Like, he was very strong in the first two episodes as well, but I think this one, he really shined. He probably had the most screen time of any character, and he was just knocking it out of the park with a variety of emotions, all the way from amiable to despondent, from angry to drunk, just a lot of moods, and man, he was fantastic. Ashay, what about you?
I'm sorry, would you go ahead without me? Something just happened on the screen.
Sean, then, go ahead.
I'm going to agree with Patty for this episode, although I feel, to me, he was about on par this episode as the last two episodes. He did get featured more. But I think for the past two episodes, Millie Alcock has been my pick. But this time, not that she did poor this time, I just think that he surpassed her in this one. But I think the two of them have each been my 1-2 for the all three episodes.
Right on.
So I'm going to say Millie again. Even if I said her before, I still think she was very good. She had a lot of range in this episode, did a lot of different things. But I also really loved Matt Smith's Damon. And less so performance, but like a highlight for me was just all three of the Strongs.
Yeah, we got to see some Strongs there.
There was a lot of personality in all three of them that just shined through very clearly.
Each of them is already distinct, even though one of them has barely spoken, and the other has only had maybe one or two more lines than that.
Yeah, exactly.
And Lionel had a really strong presence this episode.
To be clear, one of the Strongs was the one that has, I guess, a club foot, yeah, right? Mm-hmm. And then another one was, he was the one at, like, when Rhaenyra came back all bloodied up. He was like maybe skinning an animal or something, but kind of taking note of her.
Yeah.
And, you know, I couldn't tell if he was maybe even flirting with
her.
He
was into it.
But
he was into it. While Jason was cringing.
And those two strong brothers are sons of the Maester of Laws.
Yes.
Maester of Laws?
Master of Laws.
And Harwin was, his nickname is Breakbones, and he was one of the two holding the stag in place as well, which is fitting for supposedly the strongest knight in the Seven Kingdoms, is what they say. We'll see whether that's true or not, but he's got the name to match. He is the strongest knight, sort of. Yeah. Anyway, so highlight plot scene. I'm going to say Viserys again, sticking with Patty. Drunk on his angry chair. Yes, that is a reference to Alice in Chains, not Alicent Chains. In that moment, the music is very prominent. There's multiple times in this episode where the regular sounds of people and festivities are muffled, and the music really takes over, and you really focus on the character. It's not the first time it's happened in an episode this season, but it happened, I think, 4 times in this one. I can't remember it happening more than once in the other episode. Another time it happened when Viserys was preparing to announce his decision on marriage, and that was last episode. And you could barely hear what the other characters were saying, except one of them says Iron Islands, and that's the only thing you could make out.
It also happened in this episode on the Stepstones with Daemon at one point.
Yeah, you're right. That's another example of a perfect call, yeah. What about you, Ashaya? I see you're sticking with the song theme here.
Yeah, I really liked the Nymeria song. Not only because I liked any reference to Nymeria, but because it was really funny and it was really true to, I think, a lot of us can relate to the idea of, like, you get into a song and you want to listen to it 20 times in a row, but normally you don't have to make someone else sing it for you. So it was a very like modern thing that I could relate to, and I think a lot of us can.
Yeah, that's a good point, yeah.
And like, I don't get why people say the show isn't very funny. I'm like, there are a lot of funny scenes this episode, to me in particular. There's a lot of funny things.
Maybe comic relief would be the way to put it, but there was a lot of it. There was several lines that way, and yeah, this scene definitely had it.
However much humor there is or isn't in this show, if that's the reason you're watching, you might have just picked the wrong show. I mean,
what about your highlight moment, Sean?
I think I'm a little torn, but because I really like the conciliatory moment between Viserys and Rhaenyra toward the end. That was really good.
Great
but
moment.
I don't think it carried quite the same overall, I don't know how to say this, literary, artistic impact of the moment when Viserys had to kill that stag they brought to him. I thought that not only did it really kind of bring into focus what had been happening throughout that hunt, right? The idea that he's sort of in this bubble and everything's being set up for him and like, oh, here you go. Now you can kill it. Good job, sir. But really, he didn't even do it. And even if that's normal, both we as an audience, potentially many people present for that moment, and he personally all felt a little uneasy about how that was going.
Yeah,
and symbolically, it was also so representative of what had been happening to him and to all these characters around. So I think that was like tough to watch for me, at least, you know.
It was making
something tough to watch takes some effort. You have to care about what's going on and care about the characters involved. And it was so meaningful beyond that moment, and et cetera, et cetera. I think that was... I'd have been proud of myself as a writer if I brought it all into that climax, you know.
We'll have a lot to say about this scene. It's loaded with symbolism and references to things outside the story, things that have been referenced in A Song of Ice and Fire as well, so we'll have fun with that later. Later. So our favorite highlight dragon moment, I'm going to go with Sea Smoke tossing people. The flames are cool, breathing fire is awesome, but I love when a dragon just picks someone up and flings them. You've maybe seen that one or two other times, and I just think it's really cool for an action moment. Shea, what about you?
I'll say real quick that I think it would have been neat. To me, it wasn't completely clear if the people flung were quote-unquote good guys or bad guys.
If she's accidentally flung the wrong person.
I think it would have been interesting to...
Sorry, Bob!
They almost made a point in that opening sequence. It's kind of indiscriminate destruction.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's going to be my favorite dragon moment right there, was that guy going, oh, save me, my prince.
He sort of did. He put him out of his misery.
Then he just gets stepped on, because that was also my thought seeing later Sea Smoke flying through there, just lighting people on fire. I was like, he could very easily be burning their
wrong
own people.
Yeah.
Very easily.
Which reminds us a bit that there is some connection, undefined mental partition that Dragon and Rider share, whether it's Syrax knowing to target the funeral pyre, or perhaps which enemy soldiers to target in cases like this. We saw that with Daenerys as well. There's some sort of probably magical bond, but it's, you know, there's dogs are pretty good at sensing what their owners want. Not specifically like what they're targeting, not like this, but it's similar-ish to some real-world things, I'd say.
My favorite moment, by the way, was as Caraxes was landing. I think it was toward the end when... I don't know, they're having that sort of strategic meeting.
Yeah.
And Daemon flies in, and from the distance, there's the way the hind legs, the body kind of, you know, warbled into place there. I thought it was a really good presentation.
Neat, yeah.
I wanted to say also real quick that, I don't know, we could go on a million tangents about the ideas, like comparing dragons to modern weapons or the nature of destruction or whatever, but even in modern times, that's like a little less common now, but still friendly fire. Still like fire artillery and jets fly over. It was like a lot of good guys get killed by their own forces.
The bigger the bombs, the more likely someone else gets caught up in it, you know.
Yeah, and you know, even if Viserys might have this intention, or Daemon or whoever, of kill the bad guys, if there's two guys fighting with swords standing right next to each other, they're both just going down
when the flames come
through.
Yeah, that's right. So overall, I'd say this episode had incredible dialogue and characterizations. It had really excellent pacing. It took its time with the hunt scene and all that beautiful pathos and tragic symbolism. But on the other end, with the battle, it was incredibly fast-paced. So you have both opposites there. And of course, it had a continuation of the excellent acting that we're already getting quite used to. The bar just keeps going up on that. In addition to our pro awards, let's give a humorous Razzie Award, which is a real-life award for bad film. In this case, we're giving it to Hobart Hightower for his cringeworthy Hail Hail Aegon the Conqueror Babe, second of his name. Woof, that was cringe. But it was very meaningful. It shows the point here. They're pushing for this child to be the heir. They're not just pushing for it. They're just kind of saying that's what it is. They're just assuming that's the case. And
especially Hobart.
Hobart, yeah.
Hobart,
yeah.
He seems particularly, I don't know, bold about acknowledging the son, Prince, showing up, and not the princess or barely even the king. He's like, hey, everyone, it's the prince is here. Hey, applaud, yeah.
But he is Hobart High, Lord Hobart Hightower, Lord of the Hightower, Otto's older brother. So he is one of the most powerful lords in Westeros. So he does come from a position of thinking he can get away with quite a bit. He does have a lot of leeway.
And Viserys might allow people to get away with more than, I don't know, Tywin would have or whoever.
True. We already had that Baratheon comment, the queen who never was, right in his face there, and he didn't seem to be bothered by that. So, yeah, this is someone that you can get away with that around
him. We'll get
him
to it later, I'm sure, but the two ladies, Lannister and Redwine, were a little subversive in that type of gossip publicly they were having. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were just open there right in front of Rhaenyra with Alicent, his wife, sitting right there. Yeah. I mean, yeah, they weren't afraid of saying what was on their mind. So, yeah, that is really telling, I'd say.
In a way, it almost maybe is good that people feel free to speak, but
yeah, in a way
maybe
it is, yeah,
they shouldn't feel that free to speak that negatively.
Yeah, yeah. So the episode is actually called Second of His Name, like Aegon, who they're trying to make Aegon the Second. It's his it is his second birthday as well. So it's not only second of his name, but second of his name days. 3 whole years have passed because last we saw he wasn't even a seed yet, wasn't even a fetus yet. A few themes and patterns before we get into it. Things to keep as an overall view of the episode. Learning to fly in the metaphorical way, a little bit in the literal way. We see Laenor flying his dragon for the first time. It's not the first time he flew it, but the Septones will be the first time he flew it in battle. At this point, 3 years forward, he's got some experience. But still, looks like he's getting pretty good at it. Having it your way. I'm not talking about a fast food restaurant. I mean, you want it your way, and you won't do it in any other way. That's a really common part of this, getting to the point, but getting it the way you want, not anyone else's way. Pride is the primary driver of this. It's arguably a theme all of its own, especially with great lines like, his pride has pride, in reference to Jason Lannister. Viserys, of course, not necessarily recognizing that he's quite proud himself. So is his brother. So is his daughter. And they all just seem to forget how proud they all are when speaking to each other, and they're constantly stepping on each other's feet.
It's very fitting considering he's a Lannister.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
that's true. It's
pride.
It's a triple meeting. Yeah. There's also a lot of characters being on edge, lost tempers, lashing out, breaking down, rebelliousness from Rhaenyra, Daemon having his different version of petulance when his pride is very tweaked by the idea of getting help. But at the end, new perspective, rebirth. Fire and blood. In fire and blood. There's lots of fire and blood. Both Daemon and Rhaenyra and the episode covered in blood. There's fire everywhere. The huge bonfire at the hunt. The torches in the trees. A lot of the scenes are at night. Not to mention the dragons, the fire arrows. I mean, just lots of that. All three of them slay a beast, meaning all three of our Targaryens are people with Targaryen names. There's more characters with Targaryen heritage. But not, of course, counting baby Aegon, who technically is a Targaryen too. But he's too young to be killing things. He's playing with the baby dragon, but a boar, a stag, and a crab. There you go. A little more on that later, and we'll get into the details of that. A lot of nonverbal communication. A lot of people who say nothing and say it, but communicate a lot. More details on that later. And, of course, that music taking over thing, which is part of that, with the vocals being shut out, focused on the emotion and the music backing it.
You know, a lot of times, I don't know, rule of thumb for filmmaking is show me, don't tell me.
Yeah.
And in this show, in many shows, I understand they have a lot to tell us. Sometimes we need a little exposition, and they do a pretty good job with things like a tournament or a council meeting to deliver that in a little more natural way. But beyond that, in this episode, there was a lot more, you know, like seeing things without having to be told or dialogue or explained. Another thing, too, by the way, I haven't got this very thought out, but I just wanted to throw it out there and I'll think about it more. Fire and blood, there's a lot of other meanings that can have. Like, I think we usually think of it as like dragons and you know, violence and combat or whatever, but it could mean passion and family.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's still pretty fitting. And I bet there's like 20 more, you know, words you could switch out that would come up with
great
fitting
point.
Meanings. I'm going to think about that more, but I want to throw it out now.
It's pretty loaded. You're right. Yeah. So weigh in not only with your favorite moments, but your interpretations of these themes, particularly the Fire and Blood one or whichever one catches your attention the most. And any particular notable comments we might get shared on the episode here. So let's talk about the Hunts and the Hunted. It's kind of a two-way street here. Rhaenyra's sense of isolation has been growing. Though she remains heir, she expects that it's temporary. She feels herself being pushed aside, not only by actions, but by how everyone else around her is behaving. Like, they're celebrating her half-brother. They're openly calling him Your Grace and the heir. And she feels this and notices it. It's not hard not to notice. One of the few people trying to be her friend still is Alicent, but Rhaenyra just isn't hearing it. She feels too betrayed by the whole situation. She's become pretty petulant, confrontational, maybe even bitter. As Viserys says at the end of the episode, he calls her angry and alone. And of course, this is the scene where he puts her mind at ease at last, and he frankly is angry and alone too. So, and maybe Daemon is as well. That's something they all have in common.
I was going to say for her specifically, maybe for those two if you think about it, but she's kind of making it I'm hesitant to use this phrase, but a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah.
Like, I don't necessarily want to invoke prophecy because it has so much other meaning here. But she's kind of forcing everyone to keep behaving the way they are. Like, there are other avenues she could take. Like, she could... except, which is kind of what Viserys tells her in the end, like, you just need to accept the way this is, and then you can make the best of it. But right now, she just won't even accept it.
Yeah.
But she could even pretend to accept it, and then try to work around it, or work out of it, or something, but she's instead making it about the worst possible. You know?
Yeah, especially, that really comes out when she's talking to Kristen. He's like, you know, it's not as bad. He's very diplomatic about it, unlike a lot of other people who are just, like, trying to shut her down and telling her she's gone too far, or embarrassing her. He's a lot more diplomatic, and it gets through to her. And that's a common theme. It's like, when you speak to them properly, when you don't tweak their pride, they do listen. Viserys, even Daemon.
Although, to be fair, Alicent tried, and she wasn't. She was like, is that what the king wants? Okay, fine. And she like forced her to pull rank. You know what I mean?
You're right.
She won't allow her to be her friend. She won't give her an out. She won't. Yeah, she just wants to be stubborn about it. And
this is
on a lot of levels understandable. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, we'll probably talk about this more, but like, we talked a little last night. I was like thinking about the differences in this court and this time period and this group of personalities to Game of Thrones.
Very like, different, yeah.
There's not like a Cersei and a Littlefinger and a Margaery, you know, who are reading people and figuring out and plotting for the long term. These people are a little bit more like short-term, self-centered, you know.
They miss things more. They're not as good at what they do, which makes, in some ways, makes them maybe a little more believable.
Yeah.
But
some
also,
ways,
it makes more sense. They've had less adversity in their lives to turn them into people that have experience.
Some ways, maybe even it's because they're better people. Someone who's conniving like Littlefinger, of course he's going to connive, you know?
Yeah.
Like, but if they're not conniving in the first place, it doesn't make sense for them to be paying off guards and, you know, spying. And although Daemon was spying behind the walls on the council.
Yeah, Littlefinger rose through the ranks. Varys rose through the ranks. Otto was born a Hightower. Like, there's one example there of just, he didn't have to fight his way to the top. I mean, he did rise, but...
Although he is someone who is playing the game. He's more so than anyone, except maybe Alicent, who learned it from him. You know, those are the two characters who do seem to have a little bit more big picture awareness.
And, and they're both more
understanding
diplomatic
of the game that's going on. Yes,
very true.
Willing to mold what they say and what they want to the different people around them, to what's the momentum that's occurring.
Yeah, they choose their words more carefully, I guess you could say. But as we said, even they have failures. Alicent can't get through to Rhaenyra. Otto overshoots, you know, misses sometimes some of other angles. We'll have examples of that later. We thought this episode would be in the West. Looked like they'd be taking their ride all the way there, but we were wrong about that. It's more that they just went south to the Kingswood, which is closer by, and the West kind of met them there.
Just, by the way, a reminder of my unsullied nature. I didn't think that.
Well, yeah, we talked about that on our Saturday
I didn't
episode.
Disagree to it, but it just didn't occur to me.
Yeah, we talked about it on Saturday, not when you were on. So Rhaenyra at first is like, I don't want to go on the hunt. I hate the way the boar squeals when
it gets killed.
When it gets killed, and it's like, that was boar shadowing. Hey! And because she, of course, ends up doing that, it's a trial by fire. She has to go through it. It's this trial by fire and blood in this case.
I appreciated the timing there where she goes, the boars squeal like children when they're killed. And then Aegon makes like a little baby sound. Goes, and then she goes, it's discomforting.
I like also how she won't call him Aegon or her half-brother. She refers to him as Alicent Hightower's son.
Oh, you know, you remind me that Otto keeps referring it to as my grandson.
Yes.
Not your child or the king's son. How did my grandson do
this?
Yes,
he's so proud of his arrogant king to be.
Tactful even. Like, he's framing it a certain way. Yeah.
So, shout out to our friend James, who we're pretty sure is the originator of this very good pun. When the hand of the king to Viserys fixes your mistake, it's autocorrect. Yes, that's right. So yeah, the princess and the queen, she, like you said, she pulls rank. She doesn't want to, but she kind of has to, but she is like, it doesn't have to be like this. But yeah, Rhaenyra's just
not hearing
it.
She didn't even mean to.
Yeah.
Rhaenyra, I don't think she realized Rhaenyra was going to immediately do what she said. You know, she's like, right, if I remember right, she's like, is that what the king wants? And she's like, yes. Like, okay, I'll do it then. And like,
and that's
she didn't
your
give
grace.
Her a chance
yeah.
to follow up or explain. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really, really... It's sad. Yeah, and there's like a reversal of roles, because before Rhaenyra didn't hold it over her, but Rhaenyra was like the higher ranked of them before. Like she was, even before she was named heir, she was obviously the Targaryen, the only child of Viserys, and Alicent's very high ranked, but it was a bit of a, you know, it was a thing between them, and now it's kind of not just flipped, but the difference is larger. That was a great moment where Aegon... she's talking about her pregnancy and how it wasn't that bad. And she says, he came quickly without fuss. And it immediately cuts over to the nursemaid's face. And she's like, goes like a side eye, like, I don't know about that. I love that detail that we get this common person. Again, it's another example, nonverbal, but it says so much.
Yeah.
So she's like, you are totally lying. Or not lying, but you are just wrong. I don't know what exactly, but something like that. Yeah.
Framing it differently. Like, it's a better story for the realm that he came smooth and easy not troublesome or whatever.
Yeah, and I think they're maybe also thinking about how Alicent is trying to pave the way for Rhaenyra to be open to marriage and having kids. And the nurses are like, oh, okay, you're going there with her.
Yeah. So, yeah, the song as well, we have that Samwell the Bard talk about being caught between. He's like, whose orders do I follow? I just want to sing songs. Although maybe not the same song over and over. So but
he might have been more likely to take Alicent's word for it, just being done with singing that song.
How many times? What's the over-under? How many times do you think he did it already? Was that the second time or the 22nd
Yeah, it was
time?
Probably like seven. Yeah, it's probably been a lot. Yeah.
I'm going to set the line at 7.
It's an auspicious number. It's an auspicious number, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And we got some of the lyrics there. Hopefully, maybe we'll get more of them at some other point. Maybe a little off screen. They'll give us more of the lyrics.
Yeah, we got some lyrics. Under the dragon's eye, she fled with her ships and her people, her heart broken for those who had died.
Very nice.
So yeah, that is about Nymeria fleeing. And you'll note that in that scene, when we screen capped it, we could see that Rhaenyra was reading about Nymeria while she listened to a song about Nymeria.
Yeah.
in the world.
She's going full Nymeria. It's true. We noted when she took a page out of Nymeria's book in episode 1, and apparently that was not going to be the only reference to her in Nymeria. So maybe there will be even further references. So
yeah,
keep an eye out
like,
for that.
You know, we talked somewhat about some of the parallels between Rhaenyra and Nymeria before. We talked about like having multiple loves throughout her life. We talked about her being like a female ruler. But here what was emphasized to me is it starts with saying she fled with her ships. And Rhaenyra starts off in episode 1 talking about how she wants to fly away and just go eat cake. And so I feel like there's a little bit of wistfulness in Rhaenyra reading about this, about the idea of just getting away from it all.
Are you saying her ships are Kristen Cole? Because that's who she ran away with. In the you ship Kristen and Rhaenyra? Is that what you're saying? Yeah. Just kidding.
But real quick, I want to ask that they... signs of portents. Otto uses that phrase. Isn't that like a book in world too?
Yep. Yep, I have that in our references section at the end. I'm glad you caught that. So this, let's talk about the second birthday party. The hunt is... kind of for the king, but it's really more for the boy, the second birthday party. It's the whole thing is for him. Yeah. No, it really is. Yeah. Huge spectacle. The whole thing is staged to almost every detail. I mean, the hunt is just kind of absurd how everything is set up for the king. I mean, they catch the thing for him. They hold it in place. They tell him exactly where to stab. He steps on a footstool when he's getting off his horse. They clap when he's done. It's very absurd, but believable that kings are treated this way. And it really emphasizes how not down to earth he is, how detached he is from reality, and he kind of senses it, but doesn't know exactly what to do about
in
it.
He feels a little ways.
Lost. Yeah, in certain
ways. I have a million thoughts on this.
Go for it.
A couple I want to get out now, but I'm sure more are going to come throughout. But one was, I felt like it was maybe kind of weird or gross, but I think they were demonstrating that he was prepared and willing to really take part in the hunt. He got his hands dirty. Like, he grabbed
literally
the deer pellets. Like, he's not. Does that make sense? Now, despite that, clearly everyone around him was keeping him in a bubble. Like, when he goes to get on his horse, they're like, here, step up on his stool. Like, everything's kind of being hand-fed to him. But he was willing to go through the effort, it seems. And on some level, also, I think about Robert, who ended up getting himself killed hunting a boar. And on some level, maybe you can blame Cersei or Lancel for getting him too drunk or something. But also, he went out there hunting a boar. He put himself in harm's way.
He did.
And either Viserys
Viserys
and or the people around him are not being so responsible. Like, let's just say you want to go show your stuff as a huntsman. Okay, but you're not a huntsman. You're the king. You have bigger responsibilities. You know? So on a lot of levels, I can understand this, and it is probably normal. But I do also, that's part of why I like that moment when he did finally kill it, because I think it was become very clear to us and him how staged it all was. I think he really went out there to go on his hunt. But he realized through the course of it, I'm really out here to be accosted by all these people. It wasn't just set up for him to succeed in killing his deer. It was also set up for him to be confronted by all these different lords about who the heir was going
to
be. That's at least as much of a setup.
Absolutely.
That was, and I wondered if on some level, he thought, even if he didn't plan it this way, he had this background idea in his mind. I'll go out and hunt this deer. It'll be fun. But also, Rhaenyra is going to get to meet her suitors.
Yeah.
Now, he had this idea
to marry her off, and it's like this bubble. Yeah, it's like.
But he doesn't realize Otto is doing the same thing to him. It becomes clear through the way, and he gets more and more frustrated by it. Anyway, I'm going to have a million more things, but I feel like there's another certain thing I wanted to say.
We'll come back to that in a second. Yeah. Part of the point of gathering so many lords, as you said, is to just overwhelm Viserys with the idea that just. The attitude is that this boy is going to inherit. They just take it for granted, and they want to overwhelm him with just how many people see it that way. I suspect that Otto invited only certain lords, the ones that would agree with him on that, and maybe disinclined to invite some of the ones who are more likely to be staunch for Rhaenyra. And Rhaenyra maybe doesn't get that. She doesn't really realize that maybe the attendees are... There's
hand
some
selected,
hand selected,
yeah.
hand literally hand Biased, selected like, by hand the hand.
Selected. Yeah, I meant to make that pun. Of course, you know, I think it's also another misstep on Otto's part because he overwhelmed the king with it.
He did.
He put him in his defensive position.
Yes,
and so there was no one for him to relate to or confide in. It was only people who were opposed to him over and over. So it forced him to like lay down the law.
Yeah.
It got him frustrated. I think it worked against Otto's intention.
I agree.
In the end, yeah.
And this is an example of Otto maybe not being quite as smooth as a Littlefinger or a Varys. He has the right idea, but his ambition sometimes get the better of him. Perhaps he maybe doesn't think it all through. I'm not entirely sure how to frame it.
But I know how to frame it. He's too heavy-handed.
Oh!
That one I meant to do.
There you go. And, yeah, it's like the old phrase, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. Viserys, Daemon, and Alice. I'm not Alicent. Viserys, Daemon, and Rhaenyra are all like that. If you force them, they shut down. Mm. Otherwise, Viserys is quite amiable. You can convince him. You just have to be smooth about it. Alicent, again, is the master at this. She's better than anyone else, even better than her father at least so far. But you're right. This was too much of putting him into a corner and forcing him. It was like the Lena decision when everyone's telling him to marry Lena. And that actually was the problem. If maybe a fewer people had told him to marry Lena, he might have actually done it.
He even recognized it about Rhaenyra, too. He's like, if I told her not to marry the Lannister, they probably would have got married.
Yeah, he realized he doesn't see that about himself. He doesn't see how similar he is to his child and his uncle and his brother. But it's, a little bit of a blind in one eye and seeing clearly out of the other, like Crab Feeder, apparently. So, yeah, she's getting so bad, like you said, that she's like cutting off her nose to spite her face. To spite her father, she's harming her own future by shunting out potential friends and allies, which is what she needs. Like, she's isolated, she's lonely, but she's making herself more like that. She's making it worse, yeah.
Sorry, I'm distracted just because you made me think of something. Is Viserys cutting off his own finger to spite his hand?
Oh my goodness. We are really getting pony today, folks. Punch drunk with an incomplete hand? Yeah, I don't know. So, yeah, we also have these gossiping ladies, which provides another angle into this attitude of who's there and what they're saying. They openly discuss what should be done in the Stepstones. They call Corlys Velaryon the Sea Snake, which no one has called him that to his face yet. I wonder if he likes that name. I don't know yet.
It occurs to me it could be a derogatory
term.
It
might be.
Yeah, I never thought of it that way before.
It's his own ship, so I don't know that it would be that insulting, but it's not Lord Corlys, which is his, you know, that's usually what you call people by their title, especially someone that powerful and rich. So that's notable. But yeah, we've got Kira Lannister and Lady Redwine, who has her pug eating cake there. Let them eat cake. And that's a good example.
I don't know about y'all, but as much as I love seeing nice animals, I was not very happy with seeing a pug in this world, because there was a lot of stuff that went on in the background in the real world to engineer pugs to look like that.
Yeah.
So it personally did draw me out. Like, honestly, I would say I have one complaint about this episode, and it's the pug. Really? I don't have any other real complaints. I love this episode, but that, like, I was like, wait, how did they get a pug in Westeros?
It fits to me, because dogs, I don't know, 400-ish years ago, there were only like 7 different dogs in the whole world. Almost all the different weird, crazy variety of dogs that we see were bred by just rich nobles in Europe in like the 1600s or something.
Yeah, I guess I just picture them being bred later on and not in this time in Westeros. I don't imagine they have them having bred pugs.
So it doesn't take any modern technology to do it.
Right, on one hand, I agree, but we know that the Targaryens or Valyrians would do like weird breeding things, and these lord nobles with their power and their money could have weird hobbies and mess around with animals.
And birds and all that stuff.
That's a good point. You actually do make me feel better thinking about the Valyrians doing genetic modification type things.
Instead of blood magic, it's pug magic.
That might even be a way to like suck up to the Valyrians to have a pug as a pet. You know, like, like,
you can't come in unless you have a
pug.
Dogs.
We're like your ally. Yeah.
Or some other flat faced animal. Yeah. So these gossiping ladies, it's another example of she could speak to them kindly. She doesn't have to shut them down, but she feels better with this satisfying cut down than maybe finding a chord with them. It's probably unwise to talk to them that way, even though it's probably felt good in the moment. But it's another example of her just shutting down possible allies who could maybe help support her claim. Instead, she's arguably pushing them towards Baby Aegon, which is definitely not what she wants to do.
Like, even on some level, they maybe needed to be put in their place a little, but she did it in a way that
openly, they don't, their pride.
They don't feel like we have to do what she says. They feel like we have to make sure she's not the one that we have to do what they say, right? You know, we're going to support this other person now.
And one of the things they most want to avoid is being embarrassed. I mean, that's like very high on their list of things that they don't want, and she just does that. And like, everyone's sitting there, and even Allison gives her a little smile because she's like, nice one. But Rhaenyra's like, stone face, like, you too.
No, like, there was a moment where Rhaenyra does soften towards Alicent there.
It's pretty brief.
It's brief, but when Alicent says, you know, the princess is the best person for the job, essentially, Rhaenyra does have a little like, oh, thank you for that.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, there's an almost, Alicent's trying to rebuild that bridge, but it's just too broken. Let's move on to Viserys, the drunken dreamer. He loses his temper several times. One of them is with Jason. He's likely in physical pain as well as emotional. He's definitely in emotional pain. Those fingers probably hurt a lot.
Yeah, he's probably less than he was. I thought that was just something I thought was maybe even a little unrealistic in a prior episode when his finger was just black, you know, gangrene or something set in. Like, you would be ill. Your whole body, your blood would be poisoned. You would be delirious. You know, maybe they have him on drugs, but maybe excuse some mistakes he might make, you know, some misreads or loss of temper or something like that. It's probably not like happy and fine now, but probably once they cut it off, not as bad as it was.
And you can see here, it's hard to, most of the episode he has gloves on, but when he's talking to Allison after the hunt, he is right before he sends help to the Stepstones. You can see quite clearly that there are two missing fingers there.
I was looking for it too because he had gloves on so often, and in the hunt when he's holding that spear, it's a shot where his fingers are kind of up, and I thought maybe he can't grip or move them. But then when in that scene, it's first it's like they were hiding from it. It's like he had to be like halfway through the scene because I saw he didn't have gloves on, but they kept showing one hand and a camera would move, and you saw like the tip of his thumb. It's like there it is. Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah, that was a good catch. So he's fed up with the politicking. He's fed up with the endless marriage offers. He hates disappointing people. And he remarks that he's forever doomed to disappoint one person by pleasing another. He says he's on the hunt to hunt, not to politic. But as we discussed on Saturday, a royal hunt is like modern golf games at the country club. It's where the politicking happens. Like, it's kind of naive for him to think it's not going to happen there. He should have seen it coming. Lots and lots of business is discussed in places like this. This is a cover for the networking and power playing that's happening in the background. But it's an obvious cover. And it's kind of wild that Viserys doesn't see it that way. I call him a bit naive for that. And Rhaenyra doesn't get that either, I guess, because he didn't teach her that. It's not that this was an oversight of, I should have taught her this, but didn't because I don't view her as my heir. No, he didn't notice it either. And this is the old boys network. And this is something that he should have told her when he's like, why should I participate in this? Why should I? And he's like, because, you know, it's your duty. He doesn't break it down and say, this is where power happens. You need to participate in the old boys games if you want to rule the old boys. You can't rise to power by shunning where power happens. And it sucks,
remember,
but that's the case. That's
in
what's
that
happened.
Last episode when he was like, you'll learn. And I was like, learn what? You got to tell her what
exactly,
she's supposed to learn.
Yeah.
Same thing here. He's missing some opportunities. And I don't know if it's because like he just assumes she knows or should know or figure it out. Maybe he doesn't want her to know. Maybe he's just that. I don't know. Several times kind of the point has been made in many ways. He's not necessarily a good leader. But if I feel like you should improve, you know, like it's not. But I had another thought he's maybe not just naive. He might be a little stubborn. He might on some level
willful,
know it.
Yeah.
But doesn't he just is like, look, I'm here to hunt. Stop talking about this.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. He's kind of just dropping the hammer there.
Yeah.
Rather than not knowing that's how it is. He's just like, no, look. Yeah. Leave me alone. I want to hunt. Yeah, he may be not completely unaware. You're right. Maybe give him a little more credit than that.
And that might also be why Jason Lannister? No, Tywin Lannister.
Jason was the Lord, and Tywin's his younger brother, his twin brother who's...
Tywin was on the council,
yes.
Probably in the stead of Corlys, and he kept pushing, right? Like, it was clearly the king didn't want to hear it, but he kept
just
coming
like
at him.
Just like Corlys did.
Yes, yes.
And it's the same result.
Result.
Shut up.
But he also might have been... Corlys might do that because he's... No, pushy or stubborn or arrogant or whatever, or maybe fed up with Viserys. But this guy might be doing it because he doesn't know him yet. He's not.
Yeah.
He's too new at this to realize I need to back off. He's probably too young, doesn't understand the politics either, naive, whatever
that's
it is.
True.
You know?
So a question about Tyland. Are we supposed to take from this that Tyland is now ascended to master of ships while Corlys is gone?
Yeah, I think so. I think it may be a temporary appointment, but Corlys has been gone for 3 years. You think you'd have to have a master. You can't just go without a master of ships. So it makes sense that
he's reporting to him about
stuff
trade,
in the
stuff
ships.
About
yeah.
the ships. And he, in canon, was the master of ships for a time. So
yeah. So it does. It totally fits. And it's not like any of the other jobs have been. Like, we still have the same master laws. I mean, he's obviously not going to be maester, you know, and there still is no master whispers. So yeah. We didn't see the master coin, Lyman Beesbury, but we can assume he just didn't go on the trip. He's an older guy, like Melos, which is probably why he wasn't traveling with them either. Now, Ryan Condal says he was fascinated by the character of Daron the Drunken from Duncan Egg, Egg's oldest brother. You remember him? This is a similar... Now, I know it's tempting to think of Robert here and with the drinking and the hunting, and that does fit in some ways, but this is a little more subtle and fits quite well as a parallel. It's almost in reverse, though. Viserys laments that he isn't a dreamer. He had the one dream, and he's been chasing that dream again. He wants to have it back. It's like chasing the dragon. He drinks because he's sad, whereas Daron was drinking because the dreams were overwhelming, and he was trying to shut them out, to mute them, to stop the dreams, to lose himself in alcohol. He lacks the clarity that he thinks dreams could give him. He thinks the dreams are proof of what he should do. It answers questions that he doesn't know how to answer through his own decision-making process. He wants like a higher power to tell him what to do almost, but he can't get there.
You know, unsullied as I may be in this time period, I read and loved the Duncan Egg books, and I felt proud of myself for immediately realizing the parallels here. There's even, I think, more than what you're saying, because Daron was also sort of lost, right? He had one brother who was a good fighter. He was like, he had older brothers. Like, he didn't really have his role figured out. And I think Viserys is kind of in a similar situation where, like, people have these expectations for him that he doesn't know how to fulfill. You know, in addition to the dreams and his stress, and in I get the idea that the drinking is coming on in this moment or in this phase of his life, whereas Daron has, like, maybe been that way, like, since he's a teenager or whatever it was. Like, it's overcome, become the centerpiece of his character, right? Like, people know him as the drunk. That's not the case of Viserys. Yet, anyway, I worry that that may push farther. I don't know where this is going, but it seems like it's becoming an issue.
Yeah, I agree. And he has, like we've said, an unwillingness, maybe it's a willful stubbornness, or sometimes a complete blindness to his own shortcomings, especially as they compare to his family, who have the same shortcomings. He's very frustrated with people pulling him in many directions, blames a lot of other people for this, but he does blame himself for his wife, Jess. He's come around on that, and it's a very powerful confession. A lot of people at the time said it is his fault, and now he's agreeing with that. So some people probably found that a bit... like, yeah, all right, well, this is a great moment because he's admitting that.
I was glad Allison did not console him there.
Yeah.
He didn't say, oh, no, you didn't.
He's like, yeah, you may have done that.
She just like, nodded, like, yeah.
Again, she just handles it so well. Allison is just like the perfect companion for this. He says, what if I was wrong? It's so powerful. It's really, really amazing. It's really powerful. It's really amazing. And it's really hard to understand as well. It's meaning from to put yourself in his place. People, not that people haven't lost loved ones in tragic circumstances like that, but the part of the prophetic dream part, that you can't really relate to.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
What if I was wrong? When he says that, what if I was wrong based on the prophecy? That's the part he's wondering, like, well, maybe I interpreted this wrong. Was the dream right or wrong? He wrestles it with the whole time, and then it culminates with the hunt we'll get to a little bit later. But yeah, what do you have to say here?
Did I wonder if in his mind there's more than one thing he wonders if he's wrong about? Am I wrong about how I handled Daemon? Am I wrong about letting Otto be in my hand? He's probably questioning a lot of different things.
Yes. Right? And that level of superstition is part of what Otto is leveraging. This is what we said, he misplayed it a bit. He overplayed this hand, his hand, literally. And it's too unsubtle, for one thing. They're just like, everyone's just over and over, like, the White Hart is so auspicious. Eventually, he's just like, yeah, I get it. You know, it's like, it's over the top on purpose. And the reason they do that is because of this. Otto knows that he's a believer in signs and portents and stuff, so he's trying to leverage this, but it's not done well. It's he doesn't fully grasp Viserys' mind on this.
For one, he doesn't... Right.
I get the sense that Viserys hasn't shared this type of secret with Otto, but Otto's kind of aware of it.
I don't think that Otto understands the commitment that he feels to... Rhaenyra.
Oh,
that
yeah.
Makes sense.
Okay.
I think that's the thing, a primary thing, if not the thing, that Viserys is torn, is struggling internally over, is this commitment he made to his daughter. Now, mixed up in that, of course, also is the prophecy and other decisions of his life and his brother and all this other stuff. But it's not so easy to him to just flip to this new heir because he made the commitment to, and he didn't spell it out to her and the realm specifically since the new son was born. But I mean, I feel like calling all the lords up to bow down to her, like, I think it's fair for him to feel like he's made a commitment, you know.
Very good point. Yeah. And the line that I think Allison really summarizes a lot of a line that a lot of characters should take to heart if they're trying to convince someone of something is he has to think it's his decision. You can't force him into something. He has to think that is what Allison says to Viserys about Daemon, but or about Rhaenyra as well, and she's applying it to all, and it's really him as well. He falls into that umbrella too, and it's something that Otto has realized. But yeah, like we said, he's not on the level of Littlefinger or Varys, and just as Allison nails this moment, she kind of misses it on Daemon, or at least doesn't, or maybe it's fair to say that Viserys misses it. His note doesn't take into account Daemon's pride. He doesn't show understanding of what's going to bother him.
Or the optics of the aftermath. Which, yeah. That was another
Good
thing.
Point.
That's
Good
the other
point.
Thing I wanted to say earlier about the hunt.
Okay.
it was a parallel to the tournament earlier, right? We're celebrating the son's birth by having people fight and kill each other. I don't know if this violent moment is a way to celebrate the new lord, all right?
And just like what Rainey said during the tournament.
Exactly. She pointed out, she recognized it wasn't a good optic. Yeah. And it's the same thing. If Asaris had thought through how this hunt was going to go, if he had realized ahead of time, they're going to bring the stag up with two men holding it down while I stab it. And it doesn't look the best. You know, like I think he's just not thinking ahead to how things are going to play out. Like, oftentimes people have like a good idea right now, but you don't think about how it's going to play out in the long run or how it might look or how the details could have been handled differently. And I think a lot of the mistakes that Viserys is making come down to that. You know?
Yeah.
And some of the other characters, too, to be fair.
True. He has this really amazing line when he's lamenting to Alicent drinking and in front of the bonfire. He says, "What is the power of dragons next to the power of prophecy?" What a great line. There's a lot of really single lines in this episode that were just phenomenal. And yeah, it does tell you a lot about him and what he thinks and what he thinks is important and what moves him. Like, he's always been a little reluctant about dragons. Like, even when Lena, the little girl, was like trying to talk about the big dragons, he was like kind of trying to dodge the subject. He wasn't really wanting to talk about that, but she was all about it. So you had some thoughts on this as well, huh?
I still haven't gotten together. I thought so much about this on the surface, and probably what they intend is that he feels like the power of prophecy is more powerful than dragons.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But keep in mind, first of all, he thinks dragons are a power that men shouldn't have messed with.
Yeah.
So something more powerful than that. He also might think you shouldn't be messing with, especially as he's reflecting on the decisions he's made based on his dream he had and how it's not coming out like he thought. And like, maybe just like dragons, this is the wrong power to lean on or to use. Also, keep in mind the power of prophecy. Is it really a power? Like, it's knowing the future is different from being able to affect the future. And it's almost a curse, right? He keeps trying to match up to it. And it was kind of a curse to Daron. It's kind of a curse to Melisandre and Stannis, maybe. Like,
it's almost like he maybe doesn't know what he's asking for.
Right. On a lot of levels, I thought about this. Like, I think if he intended to think of the power of prophecy being more powerful than the dragons, I'm not so sure he's right about that. But he might have intended to think of it as more of a curse than even dragons. You might have a different take on this than the average person. Anyway,
and
I'm still thinking about it.
But. And he points out how one is a lot rarer than the others. Like, of the two, the dreamers are rarer than the dragon riders within his family and presumably elsewhere, but maybe not.
When Viserys says he hasn't had that dream again about Aegon, do you think he's saying he hasn't had prophetic dreams again, or just not like he wants that specific dream? Do you think he's been having other dreams?
That is unclear. I think he was very specific about that dream that
he wanted to repeat that, and which is also why I was like, well, do they often repeat prophetic dreams, period?
I think so, because a lot of the dreams we've seen are like for example, all the dreamers after the dragon die out are of the dragons returning. So it is seems to be a recurring dream, which I think adds to that Daemon Daron's like trauma from the nightmares.
Well, recurring across generations, but I more mean like once you have the dream, do you ever have it again?
No, that's what I'm saying. Daron, that's what drove Daron mad and to drink. Was he had the same dream. Yeah, he kept having the same very similar dreams about the dragons returning.
But it might be different for him than other dreamers.
Yeah.
You know, and
I think Viserys doesn't have other dreams. I don't think it's explicit, but I don't think he does.
The first time after I watched it, I came away feeling like he has dreams, like he is a dreamer, but he just hasn't had this one again. The second time I watched it, I feel like, I think he just hasn't had any more dreams.
Yeah.
I still feel like if I watch it again, I might rethink it. But on second watch, I came away feeling like he had that one dream, he doesn't have any more.
That's where I'm at, too. Is that kind of where you land on it, Shay, or do you think maybe?
I'm kind of where Sean's at, where I'm vacillating back and forth between the two, which is why I wanted to pose it to the question. I don't think that's the only dream he's ever had, but I think it might be that he hasn't had another dream since then.
Another one that he maybe registered as possibly prophetic. Maybe one will be like, oh, wow, I had that dream. And
I feel like any dream he has, he probably registers as potentially prophetic.
It does seem that he wants to be. Like, he definitely wants to have a dream. So I think if he was a dreamer, there would be more evidence of it. But anyway, we'll see. Definitely maybe a situation to keep an eye on.
It might make him feel better about having been thrust into this role, too, right?
Maybe,
like,
yeah.
He feels unworthy. You might have some amount of imposter syndrome, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not supposed to. It was supposed to be Rhaenys or someone else. I need to have a son. You know, he's trying to live up to this thing. And that's one way he could do it. If I was a dreamer, Maybe a dreamer. Yeah. Can't do anything right.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. It's a disappointment in himself. He blames himself or just, yeah, laments what's not, what could have been. All right. We're roughly at our halfway point here. Let's give a couple shout outs and take a few questions and move on. We've got lots of the same things to cover from different angles and some parts we haven't talked about yet. We haven't even barely touched on the battle yet, but more about the hunt as well as to come.
Dear Colgate, I love that you love that I love being at home. You even let me whiten my teeth from home. Because you know how I feel about getting up from my cloud couch. The Colgate Optic White LED Kit gives professional level results in just 10 minutes a day for 10 days when used as directed. And that's why, Colgate, I want you to meet my parents. Because ever since meeting you, I've been living life to the brightest. Colgate Optic White. Find it at all major retailers.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
A shout out to our Patreons and subscribers on Spotify, where you get our bonus episodes. We also have a old Valar Reedus that has been re-engineered, and some of y'all already have access to this on Patreon. It's being uploaded to our Spotify subscribers zone as well. And it's all the Daenerys Valar Reedus chapters in a row. It's a different way to take in the material, and maybe a little more appropriate given House of the Dragon is more character focused on certain individuals. It's not as sprawling a story of Game of Thrones, and that maybe puts you in the mind to focus on a single POV. And Dany is a really good one for some obvious reasons because of being a Targaryen, but also there's a lot of mention in those episodes about Kristen Cole, Rhaenyra, Rhaegar, especially the Song of Ice and Fire, the House of the Undying, and I noticed that we have Hot D for House of the Dragon. But before Hot D, we had Hot U, House of the Undying. Yes, so before Hot D, there was Hot U. And yes, I'm calling you hot. All of you. Every one of you. You're all hot. The Westerosi Ninja asks, where the heck was Rhaenys and Melys in the Stepstones, especially if they were in such trouble? We did theorize on Saturday that it would be a cool thing to happen to show up, but the bottom line is, they took about 8 months to do the CGI for a lot of the dragons, so it's not a small thing to add in another dragon. I think logically, maybe they would have had it there. On the other hand, Melys didn't participate in the Stepstones in book canon either. So,
is Melys the name of Rhaenys' dragon?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I didn't think about it too actively, but it does occur to me to think about it. Maybe it's too dangerous to have both of the Valyrian matriarch and patriarch battle there. Maybe someone needs to stay at home. And
She didn't want to be on campaign, but yeah. But they sent for more help. Maybe could have asked her to come. But yeah, I guess that just wasn't what they didn't what they want to do.
Maybe even Viserys forbid it. He's like, no, two dragons is enough.
Maybe
stay here. I don't want to send him more help. Maybe she wasn't even all behind it. That's a possibility too. She might not have necessarily been happy about Viserys about Corlys going to Daemon.
I tend to doubt that because of how threatening it was to their power potential.
That's true.
But anyway, we'll see about that. Holy Potato JD says, "What's Sean drinking?" Well, what are you drinking?
I have mixed a blueberry nectarine bang with a berry protein naked drink and good old Mountain Dew, and it's really good.
Yeah, I doubt it. For My People sends a super chat and says, Rhaenyra's blood-soaked protagonist walk was boss. Oh yeah, it was. It's a real turnaround. We were going to talk about this a little later, but no problem talking about it now. It's super symbolic to have her covered in blood. It's with the fire and everything, trial by blood and fire. She's renewed. Rhaenyra renewed. And while everyone, it's also a contrast to how she's treated at the beginning. She feels like everyone's ignoring her at first, and they kind of are. But when she walks in the camp covered in blood, they're like, whoa, boss lady. Only, like we said, only Jason was like, ew. But she had already rejected him, so that was probably like sour grapes, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I don't want you after all. You know, I didn't want you anyway.
You're not just going to sit at home and do what I say, are you?
No, yeah, exactly. I wasn't really going to build you that dragon pit anyway. That was just to sell. Yeah. So that's interesting. Yeah, I totally agree with that. It was a really powerful moment. Look at the shot on the screen here, especially looking down on the camp from afar. There's definitely that's some symbolism there, looking down on the mall, mm-hmm. like from this high ridge. White Stag walks up and she shows it mercy. Yeah, very symbolic. And of course, the White Stag is supposed to symbolize that she's the true heir. I think most people caught that. Patrice Lumumba sends a comment saying that the White Stag finding Rhaenyra symbolizes that she is the true heir and not Aegon. That's certainly how she's going to see it. Part of why it gives part of her renewed confidence is there. Might have impacted Criston Cole as well, seeing that. You know, he was the only other witness to that. And maybe he'll spread the story. Maybe she will. Maybe she'll keep it to herself. Who knows? This is a good segue to our next section. The heart in conflict with itself. Haha, you see what I did there. Brown heart and white heart. One of the few confirmed characters that we know of who had Targaryen blood but isn't one is Daemon II Blackfyre, a.k.a. Jon the Fiddler. He won't be born for 70 to 80 years. This is, of course, the plot of The Mystery Knight, the third Duncan Egg novel. But he comes to mind not just for that reason, but because he thought he was destined for greatness, but wound up in the muck and mocked as the Brown Dragon. So Brown Dragon, Brown Heart, you see where I'm going with this. He was not the object of prophecy he thought he was, just like this heart, the Brown Heart showed up to kind of disprove a lot of the auspices that Otto was trying to arrange. It was very disappointing. It really backfired on them, didn't it? But more on that in a second. Daemon II dreamt of his cousin Egg, is what it seems to be what really happened, as it turned out. Sadly, Egg too will apparently fall victim to prophecy, culminating at Summerhall, possibly including some dreams of his own. But that is another story, and also hasn't happened yet, another 150 years before that happens. Viserys has very mixed feelings about the final kill, as we've discussed in a few different ways. He's glad it's not the White Heart, because if it was, he would be wrong about his daughter's heir. It would be like, oh, maybe my son is the one. It might validate his dream. So it's kind of a relief that his dream was wrong. That proves he's not a dreamer. But maybe...
it might just prove that he's misinterpreting his dream also.
Yeah.
It's, you know, that's the power you should want. It's not the power of prophecy. The power to properly interpret prophecy. That's the power you really want.
Yeah, so this really backfired on Otto and Jason and all them because they were setting this up to be an auspicious omen, and it turns out to be an inauspicious omen. It doesn't just backfire. It backfires on the superstitious side. They put too many eggs in one basket on this. Mm. And it totally, yeah, it Summerhauled on them. It went from good omen to bad omen. I mean, it's like Robert Baratheon, the stag that's had its throat ripped out by a direwolf that in turn kills the direwolf to begin your Game of Thrones. Super symbolic. This is very similar here. Similar energy. And especially because this moment is interpreted as prophetic by Viserys and reinforces his belief in his daughter. He later tells her, I was wavering, but I'm not going to waver anymore. Like, things have shown to me. I'm going to reinvigorate my support for you, restate it, make it clear. Very, very similar to what we were seeing with Robert and Ned and all that symbolism and prophecy and foreshadowing for them.
Two things. One, I just now registered what you meant when you said too many eggs in one basket. So I acknowledge that real quick. Also, just another thought about prophecy or the nature of it or whatever.
Sure.
Not that there's a right way to do it, or it's hard to know how you would behave in a world that had fantastic elements. But I feel like if there's a prophecy, I would just do what I was going to do anyway and not worry about the prophecy is going to happen. Trying to make it happen, if you really believe in it, then you shouldn't need to fulfill it per se.
Yeah.
It's going to happen anyway. Whatever you do will lead to that. That's would be the approach I would take.
It's like it's going to happen no matter what I do.
Like even if I'm doing the wrong thing, like if a Targaryen needs to be on the throne for the prophecy to come true and I don't have a son, well, that must mean some other Targaryen is going to come along. That's it. If I don't do it, it doesn't mean the prophecy is not going to happen. I think if you believe in a prophecy, right?
I don't know. So when she runs off, Criston Cole runs off with her, and this is kind of a sign of how few supporters she has at this point. They kind of joke and play around a bit, and there's some smiles back and forth, but it gets serious when it gets dark. There's the joke about, do you want me to kill him, about Jason, and yeah, that's kind of funny. And there's this point about Criston having adventurous youth, and to talk about the differences and what his options for marriage were versus what hers were. And she reveals her own kind of sheltered nature a bit, where she doesn't kind of get how other people's lives are. She kind of says, woe is me, when she doesn't really realize that There's woe is me. If you're a common born person, it's probably quite a bit worse. Like, yes, you have to put up with your dad putting you to the side. It would be so much worse if you were a commoner. She just
doesn't.
You
think
a
common girl doesn't get put aside by her dad?
Yeah, or worse. Like, yeah, like your dad doesn't.
Think that dad's not arranging a marriage also.
There
are
far worse fathers out there. Yeah. He reminds her that she has more power than she thinks. He helps Rhaenyra kind of realize that she doesn't have as few options as she thinks she does. She's like, look, you made me a Kingsguard. You lifted me up. Maybe you should acknowledge that that's a significant source of power. Like, you changed my life. Everything I have, I owe to you. You know, and like, you completely changed my whole story. My whole house has never had an honor this big. You changed my whole house. Like, and she's like, huh, okay. Yeah, I guess I didn't see that. It's a very good bit of dialogue there and very meaningful.
It's another thing I try to remind myself of also that I had this thought watching Reservation Dogs that I can't believe these teenagers don't perfectly understand emotions and relationships. Of course, it makes sense that she needs to learn some lessons. She's not going to do everything right, but she's a little, some of her mistakes are some, she's kind of caught up in her own head or being stubborn or whatever it is. But, you know, I had the same thought about Sansa. Like, what do we think that this 13-year-old girl going to make perfect political plays up against Cersei and Littlefinger? Of course she's going to make some errors, but she's also going to grow and learn. And I assume Rhaenyra will too. Hopefully a bunch of people don't go get killed in the meantime. You know, that's the danger here. But
so there's also the moment with the boar actual attacks. Again, this is a reminder of Robert's boar. Of course, Rhaenyra survives. Robert is killed by it. Of course, she's not trying to take on all the danger herself. This scene had people exclaiming in the theater. It was pretty neat. There's also a really symbolic moment here when he draws his sword very slowly. There's that very slight sound. He's trying to draw it quietly, but the camera's focused on Rhaenyra. That's very sexual. Drawing his sword while the camera's focused on her, I think that's suggestive. So something to keep in mind. Possible foreshadowing there. And as well, I meant to mention the mercy of letting the White Hart go, even though, Kristen wasn't going to be able to kill it anyway.
Yeah.
It was going to run away pretty much no matter what. And if it did come at him, I mean, he has a chance to kill it, but probably not.
He might kill it, but he'll probably get killed trying.
He might,
that thing was 10 feet tall. Probably weighed at least 1,000. I don't know if a lion could get that. It would be a close match, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So, but if the point is mercy. They show mercy to it, especially her. And which is also a callback to the mercy shown to the direwolves, with Ned first wants to kill them, but he's talked into it by Jon. Jon being the master of ghosts, who is perhaps the best parallel here to the White Hart itself, the one that is almost left behind, that's Theon thinks is the runt of the litter and is most likely to die. And that makes Jon mad. He's like, no way, this one's mine, Greyjoy. I'm going to take care of it and raise him, etc. All right, real brief thing about hearts and stags and all this stuff outside of this scene, just as a general symbol. A few people have already mentioned how it's an auspice for being a king or ruler. That's not just a Westeros thing. That's a real world thing. There's lots of myths, Celtic.
It's worth noting that the word, it's H-A-R-T.
H-A-R-T.
I mean, maybe in some ancient linguist reference to your heart beating in your chest.
It is. It is. Definitely. That is a reference that is part of the origin of the word, apparently. A hart and a stag is pretty much the same thing. They're both adult male deers. The opposite of a hart and gender-wise is a hind. There's very slight difference between hart and stag. Like, stag is definitely an adult. A hart is any male deer, but usually an adult. So it's very pretty much the same thing. They aren't white because of albinism, but because of leucism, which saps pigment in all skin types, not just melanin. And that's why they don't have red eyes, because most albinos have red eyes. The White Hart was the sigil of Richard II of England. It's a crown stag. In fact, Ashay can pull up the picture here. Like the Baratheon sigil, it's the crown stag with the crown around its neck. But instead of the golden and black stag of House Baratheon, it's the white and golden stag. Many people, including Shakespeare, lay the bulk of the blame on the Wars of the Roses to Richard II. And, of course, the Wars of the Roses are a huge influence on the early parts of Game of Thrones, the Starks and the Lannisters representing the Yorks and Lancasters. The White Hart... The picture's from the article. The White Hart is the fifth most popular name for pubs in England. It's long been an IRL tradition in many places, Celtic, even Catholic. The stories of St. Eustace and St. Hubert involve visions of Christ between stag's antlers. There's the image on screen. You can see the similarity to the Baratheon sigil because the crown's in the same spot. And in modern times, the white heart is a symbol of scouts, Boy Scouts. The scouting, the International Boy Scouts and all that. So, yeah, pretty big, and pretty cool. Let's talk a little more about Alicent, builder of bridges. Not just a high tower, but a strong bridge. While so many of these characters misjudge each other, using the wrong tactics to gain consensus and to win alliances and friends, Alicent stands out as quite skilled. It's her who convinces Viserys about the Stepstones. After so many others fail, she uses the right tactic to get through to him, puts it in perspective properly, makes it not about pride, makes it about the realm rather than his personal relationship with his brother. It works. And I really notice how she speaks to him. The way she has a lot of different ways to approach him. It's very subtle. She calls him your grace at certain times, calls him my love at other times. And in this moment, she says, what do you think of Viserys? She actually calls him by his first name, which I think is the first time that happens. It's a really subtle clue to how, like, the different ways she knows how to, like, not manipulate him, because she's not out for herself. It's positive manipulation, I guess. You can still call it manipulation, but it's not.
Set the tone for what you're saying in a moment, and like sometimes could be more or less positive or negative. I know when I was young, my sisters were mad at my parents. Instead of mommy and daddy, they became mother and father.
You know? Yeah, it's like when you call someone by a nickname or a shortened version of their name, and then you call them by their full name. You know, it's like, my name is Aziz. I go by my actual first name is Abishai. Aziz, my middle name is like Abishai. You know, I'd be like, oh, okay, that's what did I do? So another thing Alicent does, it's revealed.
For me, it's just like I really thought about just is the king.
Yeah.
You're calling the king by his first name. You're the queen. You have that right. And she's exercising her right as queen.
But she uses it sparingly, apparently.
Yes,
which is interesting. Yeah.
And privately.
Yes. Yeah. You're right. Yeah. She's very careful around his pride. Yeah. That's really important. She's very aware of these undercurrents of what moves people.
Not just him, though, because think how other people around would perceive it, too. If she called him Viserys in public, they might be like, who does she think she is?
Yeah.
She might lose some standing in their eyes. Yeah. People might maneuver against her or
start
whatever.
Some gossips or something. Yeah. And another piece of insight is she predicted how Rhaenyra would react to Lord Jason's offer. She was right. So it's like, she doesn't say you should have listened to me. But she does kind of like imply that. She's like, oh, I kind of said that would happen, you know?
Yeah, just remind him that
I was right, you know?
A take on this. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe you should listen to me more often. And then he does. He listens to her about Daemon. So it kind of does immediately happen. There's also a really interesting scene with her and her father. She's on edge around him almost every time. Every time they have a scene together, she's just reserved, holding back. Definitely has issues with him. I mean, you can see why. But I'm very curious how this is going to continue to play out, because he keeps pushing her. He wants her to convince Viserys to make Aegon heir. And he knows that it's going to take the slow, careful convincing, not the forcing. That's the other thing. Remember how he offers to marry his daughter? Or her to his son, or his grandson, like, yeah, marry the 17-year-old to the 2-year-old. And Cersei's is like, what? You know, he doesn't reject it on incest grounds. he just rejects it on age grounds.
But yeah. Think what a win that would be for Otto.
Yeah, if
right?
He pulled
that's
that
just
off,
like
yeah.
Everything that he wants to happen comes from that move, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it works on a few levels, because even if it doesn't actually, like, even if he doesn't actually want Aegon and Rhaenyra to get married, it makes it so that Rhaenyra doesn't get married and have an alliance and isn't having kids. She's locked up for 12 years or whatever until he's, let's say, 14. She's not having kids until then. So that gives him plenty of time to have that not actually happen.
No other house becomes a rival. No other child heir is creating contention, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
Our friend Rudy was here, called it a free roll. He's like, well, he doesn't really lose much by making that request. And if Viserys rejects it, which he did, he can just go, okay, never mind. Back off, you know? And it's like, okay. He's like, yeah, but he's like, it would stop all the flood of marriage offers. It would at least be that. And he's like, yeah, but he's two. Yeah. He's like, all right, never mind. So, yeah, that was pretty pretty interesting. Now, about Alicent as well, she kind of dodges the question when she's like, don't you want your son to be king? She doesn't say yes. She doesn't say I do. She says, what mother wouldn't?
Yeah.
It's like, actually me. I'm mother who wouldn't. Maybe. I'm not saying she's saying that either, but it's very interesting that she doesn't give him a direct answer.
And she definitely disagrees with him about stealing Rhaenyra's crown. She's like, why would I raise my son to steal his sister's crown? Which is, in canon, that line does come up later. For spoiler reasons, I won't say where, but a lot of you'll know. I'll point it out on Saturday. So that is a callback to Fire and Blood as well.
I think it's just another example of her thinking ahead to how things will look. Where he's not, right? He just hadn't considered it. Maybe that piece of it isn't enough to change the decision. But he's not even thinking about that. She is, right? She's thinking, she's more forward thinking. I was also going to point out, if I didn't say it already, that through the episode, I feel like they made a point of showing her observing the different interactions going on. More so than anyone else. She seems to be more keen on what's happening, what people's intentions are, who's talking to each other. And
there's shots of her just looking at her face and watching her, like, her eyes move back and forth as she's, like, looking at...
She's observing. She's seen Jason talk to Rhaenyra. You know, whether she knew ahead of time, she understands what's happening right now. Yeah. She probably has an awareness of what this whole hunt is about. You know, she seems more aware of what's happening now and of how things will play out in the long run, too.
Yeah, well said, well said. And moving on. Okay, talking about Viserys coming around. This is his other great moment. The lamenting in front of the fire was really powerful. But this is one that you go, all right, because he's doing what seems to be good choices. Seems to be a moment of good fathering. Several different aspects of it are high quality. He gives Rhaenyra his promise, and it's a severe promise. He swears on his dead wife's grave, her mother's grave. It's a pretty major oath to take there. She seems to be moved by that. That great moment when he's like, you gotta marry for advantage. You gotta marry for advantage. He's like, she's like, you didn't marry. You would have married Lyanna Valerian if it was about advantage. He's like, fair point.
That is true enough.
Yeah, he's like, yeah, that is true enough. That's what he says. And it's true. And that's to his credit. You know, he's like, you're right. You know, and that takes her aback that he admits it. He's like, oh. She's like, oh, you actually admit that. Okay, fair enough. On the other hand, he's like, look, I didn't fully marry for love. He doesn't use the example of Duncan the Small, because Duncan the Small hasn't happened yet. That's many years later. But Duncan the Small marries an actual common-born girl and is thus completely locked out of the line of succession. He just has to abdicate his spot next in line. Whereas Viserys is more like, okay, I didn't marry the most advantageous person, but I still married a Hightower. That's still very powerful.
He married in the first place. At a certain level, if he had his druthers, he wouldn't have even remarried at all.
That's true. He said
he didn't expect to, you know, much less to have another son coming. So
he's not like saying so he backs off a little bit and says, okay, look, I'll let you choose your own husband, but you got to be smart about it. You know, don't just marry a rando. Stop sabotaging yourself to get back at me. If you're going to be rebellious, be smart about it. Don't be petulant. Don't cut off your nose to spite your face. Use this opportunity to gain advantage, not see it as a burden. There's a lot of powerful houses out there that might support you and make your claim stronger. It's like, you got to look at it that way rather than just some thing you have to do.
I feel like it wasn't even just him saying, I'll let you marry who you want. It was him saying, go ahead. And like, I'm not stopping you. You can do, like, you have to marry someone.
Permission sounds too.
You're not doing what you need to do for your role, right?
Yeah.
That's what he's telling her. And so if you're not going to do it, I'm going to try to find you a match. But you can just go find your own match. We don't have to have this contention between us.
That's a good point. Yeah. He's framing it as something she needs to do, not something that he needs her to do, which is important. Then she feels less pressured from him and more about the situation, what's best for her.
She see you know, with him.
Yeah.
What's in it for me? He's trying to get her to see what's in it for her.
Yeah, because she keeps thinking that it's all for him. She's like, oh, you want me to, like, just prop your cord up by marrying someone of your choice and making you more powerful? And he's like, no, well, that would be good for me, but it's really more about what it gets you.
And I wonder if on some level he was inspired by a Strong. What's the guy's name? Is it Robert Strong?
Harwin. No, sorry, Lionel.
Lionel Strong.
The good
because he basically said the same thing. He when he came to him with the suggestion, like, let me guess, marry your son. He's like, oh, that'd be nice, but that's not really the best thing. Here's the best thing.
Yeah.
And he's recognizing this guy is trying to figure out the best thing in general, not just this personal gain. And so it makes him realize, oh, that. Let me pitch it that way to Rhaenyra. Like, he's learned a lot of lessons, and including in this scene, he's finally doing what I wanted, which is helping her, teaching her. You know, she to learn, he needs to teach her the lesson. He's finally doing it. This is the best conversation they've had.
By far.
It's a frustration I've had. Understandable. I don't think it's like a flaw in the writing. It's a flaw in the characters.
Yes.
But there's a lot of miscommunication.
Yes.
A lot of the conflicts and issues wouldn't be there if they really understood each other better.
Mm-hmm.
And on some level, they might understand each other better if there's master whisperers. You know, even someone who's conniving could still, like, reveal the truth to them to cut off, you know, conflicts. And I think that they're missing this awareness of the need for more information or for a counselor or just to be able to communicate with each other better. Like, it's especially when they have these blind spots in their stubbornness or pride or whatever else. And even if they don't see it in themselves, they've got to see it in each other. So when all of them all see it in each other, at what point do you realize we need a counselor? We need a counselor.
Yeah.
We need to get, you know, yeah.
He's basically saying, like, look, baby Aegon has all these supporters. Get some of your own and make some of your own. He says, multiply. He's like, yeah, that's a good point. You know, it's almost like her pride has taught her the best way to play the Game of Thrones is not to play at all. But he's reminding her, look, you're in the game, whether you want to be or not. You may as well play it, be a player, not a piece. Mm-hmm. And the show has given us lots of chess pieces, like actual, like, you know, the piece, the dragon and the squids and the Valyrian sigil pieces and all that. I like the little chess pieces everywhere, the Kingsguard pieces and all that. Yeah, we'll be buying. I'm sure those are all be in the stores, you know, if they aren't already. I like that you brought up the marriage offers from Lionel Strong. That's the next section I have here. Jason's offer. It's almost hilarious. Like, this is like the stereotype rich playboy type was like, my castle is the tallest. I'm so rich. I'm so great, you know? And he's like, oh, my brother's so boring, you know? He's just like, it's like, that wasn't necessary, you know? But he's like super dripping with this like hyper masculinity and pride. And it really makes a poor impression, not just on her, but on Viserys. Viserys doesn't like him either.
Yeah.
They both are.
There's like a moment early on before Jason even talks to Rhaenyra where like Jason's kind of leering at Rhaenyra and Viserys like sees it and he looks like very discomforted.
I think that's his first impression. He's like, okay, this was a, he already is thinking this is a bad idea. Yeah. And yeah, and the way he reacts towards the spear, he's like, you think we lack strength? He's like picking a fight with him. He's like, what are you saying? And he's like, I'm just saying. And he missed really the line. He missed that chance for the pun, didn't he?
What?
When he says, he's like, well, if someone offered you more dragons, you'd take it, right? He's like, do you have dragons to offer? He could have said
golden dragons.
Yeah, but he's too slow on the uptake. Not a punster, this Jason Lannister.
Yeah, he takes after, I guess, Jaime, not Tyrion.
Yeah, not Tyrion.
I do want to point out, though, that it does show that Viserys isn't completely incompetent here.
He
was reading his situation. He's clever. It's happened a couple other times before, too. Like,
he
doesn't always make the best play, but he doesn't always make the worst play either. He's not completely incompetent.
Yeah,
and
I agree.
It's a tough balance to have this person be an okay king. You know what I mean? He's not bad, but he's not great. And I think it's a challenge for both the writers and the actor to walk this line.
Well said. And this is perhaps a familiar face, if you all maybe recognize this character. Well, both characters, because the actor is Jefferson Hall. This isn't a case of two twins in real life playing different characters. Jefferson Hall is playing both Jason and Tyland. He was also Hugh of the Vale in season one of Game of Thrones, the one killed by Gregor. And he was also Torsten in Vikings, who had a long run as he was the last of Ragnar's companions to die, the one that has his arm amputated and has an epic death that most certainly got him to Valhalla.
Spoiler alert, some of the characters in Vikings die.
Yeah, one or two. He makes that claim, I can build a dragon pit. Like, whoa, like, yeah, I guess you can. You are the Lord of Casual, like, you are ridiculously wealthy. And it's kind of interesting, like, I wonder if he's just talking big and saying, you know, like, showcasing his wealth, pours out the wine. He gets called arrogant and self-serious, and that's a great line, isn't it? Yeah. I thought he's arrogant and self-serious. Like, what does Viserys say in response to that?
He says, you might be able to relate to that.
Yeah, he might have been conversing like that. He's like, yeah. He's like, yep. She's like, oh, good line. Yeah. So that's another example, another comic relief there.
That line was very funny to me. In general, that whole scene with Rhaenyra and Jason was very funny.
That was really good. Yeah. You wonder if he's playing both sides a bit. He tells Viserys that she would be well compensated for her loss of station. He's like, what loss of station? Well, yeah, she's clearly the child. Your boy's son is the heir, right? You know, and she would be the Lady of Casterly Rock. She's being demoted from heir to the throne to Lady of Casterly Rock. Still a very high position, but a demotion. He's kind of implying that she's going to be no threat anymore. Even to him, he's saying that and offering the spear in support of the new son. The new boy's like, I support him. But if he's telling her, if he's serious about the dragon pit, that's kind of like saying, we could be the next House Valyrian. We could have dragons too. And that isn't exactly not threatening the crown's power, acquiring dragons of their own. And in canon, there's multiple attempts by the Lannisters of this era to acquire dragon eggs. The ones who took care of Aegon and Rhaena, Aegon the Uncrowned, the one killed by Maegor, he asked, after Aegon was killed, he asked Rhaena, he's like, you know, one of those dragon eggs would make a great gift for my hospitality that I've kept you here all this time and protected you against your enemies. You know, you could just give me an egg. And she's like, it's time to go.
Maybe she should have given him the egg.
Maybe.
But, yeah, they can't tame that dragon. Like, good luck.
Yeah, here you go. What are you going to do with that thing? Yeah, so anyway, and that brings us perhaps to this example. We see our first example of a house besides the Targaryens, the dragon. The dragon Sea Smoke, the gloriously gray dragon of House Velaryon ridden by Ser Laenor. That, we'll come back to that in a minute, but that is, this is what you'd get if the Lannisters had dragons. Well, theirs maybe would be more appropriately gold or red, but they'd take any dragon, I'm sure.
Change your house colors if you get a new dragon.
A lion and a dragon. Just put some wings on the lion. Like Bittersteel Sigil is a horse with wings breathing fire. They could have a fire-breathing lion with wings.
Chloe of Girls Gone Canon tweeted, and I can't unsee it, that Sea Smoke has a soul patch.
Oh my God, he does have a soul patch. Wow.
That's what I see for sure as well.
Sea Smoke might look the most like the first show's dragons.
Yeah, I would agree. Of the ones we've seen so far.
Yeah, there's more we haven't seen yet, but yeah. So a little more about Lionel, that advice you brought him up. He seems to be a legitimately good counselor. His advice seems honest, correct, unencumbered by ambition. He's like, nope, I wasn't talking about my son. That would be great, but no, I think the best thing for the realm would be to marry this rider of Sea Smoke, who he doesn't mention Sea Smoke, but we find that out. This Ser Laenor, who also shows a lot of competence in the meeting and all that.
I mean, what Lionel does there doesn't seem self-serving.
Yeah, maybe it is, but it doesn't come off that way.
I think he realizes that he is undermining Otto by doing this sort of thing.
That's a good point.
By saying, hey, he counseled you poorly to do this. Yeah. Your hand is what led you to this situation. I told you the correct thing to do. And again, I'm going to tell you the correct thing to do, not the thing that best serves me, even though really it will ultimately serve him to give him good advice.
Yeah, that's true. It brings him more into his confidence and all that.
He might not be doing it for that reason, but it does end up happening.
It has
that
result. Yeah, good point.
And also, I want to point out that maybe he is giving him the quote-unquote best advice from some sort of like big picture political legacy standpoint. But he still wanted the 40-something-year-old man to marry a 12-year-old girl. He still is not exactly giving the best advice, right? Like, he could have advised the Rhaenyra marry.
That could have been his first suggestion.
Yeah, he could have suggested it.
Lainor, is that the right name?
Lainor, Lainor and Rhaenyra, So
that would have been more of a compromise of like the best political play, but the more appropriate age marriage or whatever, you know.
So one last character. We mentioned Larys the Clubfoot, and small spoiler, this character is going to be a little more important, so keep an eye on him. He sits at the women's table and listens to them gossiping. He's one thing we'll say about him, he's observant. He's a listener, and that's going to be important later. And there he is, standing there with his cane and his gloves, and
I wonder if he has some Tyrion parallel. He's got to make up for this disability by being smart or clever or whatever.
You might
whatever
be on the right track there, Sean.
Also, wasn't there a Tyrell that had some sort of like a leg?
Willis Tyrell, the heir, the actual heir, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. That was the one they were going to try to marry Sansa.
I don't know as much about that character. I don't.
He hasn't been on
screen. There wasn't as much to that character, but. Yeah.
You know, I love that Larys was sitting at the women's court, the little women's table there, and that he plays it off, you know, like so that they don't think much of him sitting there.
Oh, I just need to sit down because of my foot. But
he's
really,
like, I'm not meant for hunting, yeah.
Yeah, but really, he's like, oh, I'm going to get all the tea, all the gossip.
All the tea and cakes as he takes a bite. Yeah, you're right. He was just kind of playing it off like, I need a place to sit. But yeah, he's like listening and like, yeah, because he knows like what the women are gossiping about is important. Like, it tells you a lot. It can tell you, like, it can reflect on what their husbands are thinking or what their individual court think and, what public opinion is. And
even
and
the same information that other people might have through a different lens is valuable, right?
Yes.
A different perspective on someone's opinion of it or whatever. Yeah.
It's also what they're willing to say in public matters versus maybe what he thinks they're actually thinking. It's like, how far are they willing to go? What are they, you know, where is their limit, right? What is taboo and what isn't? So let's talk about the battle. It's this.
Did I just miss when you brought up Harwin there?
We talked about him already.
Oh, just there. Okay. I really
We've talked about him off and on throughout the whole episode. Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to shout.
You had something else to say about him?
Yeah. I just really wanted to shout out Harwin Strong for just like with literally one look capturing the hearts of like a huge audience. Like, I mean, literally he just gives her one grin and like a theater of people is like, oh, we're swooning for you.
They all, a lot of people are making Dario comparisons.
Yeah,
there.
Dario and Tormund comparison.
Tormund, yes. Yeah. Right on.
But yeah, anyways, I just really, I'm really excited to see more of that actor because personally I was disappointed in his casting originally because it's Harwin Breakbone Strong. He's supposed to be the strongest knight. And you look at him here and he's like, he's pretty average looking. Like, he doesn't look like he's the strongest knight in the realm, but
he's no Gregor. Yeah.
I can see why they cast him if he has such charisma and just like one look.
Yeah, you're right. Like, that was a look. It really was. Yeah.
There's more than one way to be strong. Right?
Yeah, like, yeah. Especially in that family.
Yeah, he could have strength of character, and he could also have a, like...
There it is. There's the look.
Also, sometimes it can be deceiving how much muscle is underneath clothes. You know, you have, like, or four people wearing leather garments. They could have a lot of different strength underneath that.
So, Sean, you want to seem shirtless, huh?
Yes, yes.
And then you'll render your final decision.
And also, there's even different types of strength, too. Like, someone who might be able to, I don't know, bench press 400 pounds, but they might barely be able to do one pull-up. Where another guy can only bench press 100 pounds, but might do 20 pull-ups. And so, it's like a relative strength versus personal fitness kind of thing.
He can do he can do 20 stag holds. Yeah, something. So yeah, let's talk about the battle, the crab hunt, we'll call it. The burning seahorse flag is kind of how it gets lit in during the intro. It's not quite ice and fire, but the idea of a deep sea creature on fire is kind of a interesting opposition of symbols there. We have Caraxes unleashed. The nickname Longboy is probably going to stick. I really do like that nickname. The poor stomped on guy that we talked about at the beginning is sort of like the narrator in that intro scene. He's like the only one talking. He's yelling even like throughout Daemon's stuff. And yeah, he tells the crab feeder that he's going to get fed to his own crabs, which pretty much happens. It's Vaemond, brother to Corlys, who reaches the breaking point first, perhaps the one man not overwhelmed by pride who actually asks for help, but he, of course, also goes too far with this. He's on the verge of mutiny. Corlys shuts him down when he tries to say we shouldn't be following Daemon, and Elaenor calls him the master of complaints, which that's a line that will live forever. People are already appointing master of complaints to their virtual small councils.
Yeah, I've seen some display names that they're now master of complaints. And yeah, I gave Elaenor some nice personality there because that really is something we didn't know a lot about him as a character. I mean, that's been true for most of these characters, really.
Yeah.
So I've been really enjoying seeing what direction they go with. And Elaenor was competent and had a certain wit to him. He was quick on his feet.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe he was a little more Jamie-like.
Jamie might be a good comparison. And he also seemed to like genuinely like really enjoy riding his dragon. There's that part when he's like riding the dragon, he goes woo.
When he threw them in, when the thing I called out, he goes woo, and he did that, and he was yelling Drakkaris. He's not like intense about it. He's like, yeah, it's like pleasant. He's like happy. He's like, yeah.
Which
Drakkaris.
Actually, think back to in the first episode, the tourney scene when young Elaenor there, how excited he was by the tourney.
Elaenor was like, whoa.
Yeah, so like he was like, see the difference between them.
Which all this makes me think about Sandor saying, like, knights are killers. Like, yes. I don't know how good it is to be happy about riding your dragon and killing people. Like, I don't know.
A bit of a thrill seeker, maybe. Yeah. A little adrenaline junkie or something like that, maybe, is what they're telling us. I don't know.
But, I'll volunteer to be master complaints about this whole battle section, by the way.
And it's important for the idea that he could marry Rhaenyra. That's obviously being floated. Whether or not it happens, we'll see. But showing this is something that she expressed before. She wants someone with experience, and needs someone with prestige. Well, he's got that. She also wants someone she loves. That remains to be seen. So we'll see. We have no idea. You know, at this point, it would be premature to say how they would get along. Yeah, Seasmoke was awesome.
I don't even know right now if that is a priority to her.
Maybe not. Yeah.
Because she doesn't seem particularly interested in boys, even before all this. She wants to ride her dragon. She wants to do her own thing, you know? So
maybe that's something they can bond over. Or not. Yeah. So yeah, Seasmoke was amazing. A bit sneakier, maybe giving their color, like hides. He can hide in the mist a bit, like makes the surprise a little more believable. If Crabfeeder's looking for Caraxes and is like, oh crap, the darker one. So yeah, Crabfeeder never did speak. We kind of figured maybe he would eventually. He never did. I thought it was kind of neat how he's just directing people with nods of his head. It gives him a little more villainous nature, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
One of his, and it makes sense because Grayscale, maybe it made him mute. Maybe his tongue he'd lost it. Like that would probably happen. That's a theory in A Song of Ice and Fire. Not a popular theory, but the Tyrion's tongue would become grayscale because he fell in the water and he would lose the thing that defines him.
Kind of like Jamie lost his hand, yeah.
Yeah, so that's the theory no one wants, but it could happen. He also has a little bit of John Connington vibe here, a person who knows they're dying. A person who's like 100% sure they're dying. They have a limited amount of time to accomplish their goals. Their goals are very brutal, and they're not. That gives them very little sensitivity to other people. They're like, there's no sympathy. It's like, well, I'm dying and I'm in pain all the time. It's hard to find empathy or sympathy for other people. Not that it justifies it, of course, but it kind of adds to his villainousness. But interestingly, Daemon never speaks either, except for in the intro when he's calling for Drahar to come out and fight him, which he's obviously not because he's on a dragon. Like, I'm not coming out to fight you one-on-one. Come on, are you kidding me, man? Really interesting moment when Caraxes screams in pain when Daemon's hit by an arrow, which another bit of the connection between rider and dragon. They're drawing more connections there. He takes that message, says nothing, just beats the messenger up. Talk about kill the messenger. Don't kill the messenger. That's Joffrey Lonmouth who pulls the messenger away from Daemon, or pulls Daemon off the messenger.
I want that to come back and haunt him. I want there to be a repercussion for attacking a messenger like that.
Maybe there will be. It's funny that the messenger is so oblivious. He's marching up to this camp that's like they're decrepit, they're beaten down, and he's like, I have to say the full title. A message from King Viserys, Lord of the Andals and the First Men, King of the Rhoynar. And Daemon is like, shut up with that damn title. Yeah. You know, he's so proud already.
He would have been so much better off saying, not even just saying the king, but saying your brother.
Yes.
That's what he should have said.
That's what he should have, yes. Your brother the king. Like, still give him his proper style, but, you know. So, yeah, real don't kill the messenger moment. This somewhat backs Vaemond's claim that Daemon is a bad leader, but that isn't necessarily a reason to mutiny, but it does kind of emphasize what he's saying there. And Tywin reports that Daemon is pushing them too hard. His men, men too hard. That's said at the beginning, and that's, well, nothing like beating your own man to show that you're going too far. So he won't accept help. Victory on his terms or death. Now, the actual action of the hand-to-hand combat I didn't love. I didn't hate it either. I mean, it's the same kind of standard complaints we often make with battle. I don't think we need to rehash that. It's like some of it isn't believable. Some of it is like the planning doesn't initially make sense. Some of this layout, you know, it's like, yeah, go ahead, Master of Complaints. Anything you want to add to that?
Yeah. Well, first, before Sean does his Master of Complaints, I'll give my one. Like, Daemon wasn't even dodging the arrows. He was not doing
outrunning
them.
He was not
zigzagging.
He was Rickonning it.
He was Rickonning it, but he didn't get shot. So that was the one thing in the battle that I'm like, yeah, I know that's normal. But it was just a little too many arrows. Just a little bit much.
He did get shot, what, three times? Plus the one time at the beginning. But yeah, still, there was like 1,000 arrows.
Yeah, I would have preferred if it was like half that number of arrows and he got shot once at the beginning and then like another at the end, you know? Like,
yeah.
I feel like they could have executed it a little bit better to where he still avoided a lot of arrows.
Yeah, there's a few tweaks they could have done to make me believe it more, if you will. And even beyond the details of the battle, which, you know, like just a few less archers firing at him or something like that, the segment in general seemed, I don't necessarily want to be too negative, because I think overall they conveyed what they needed to convey.
Yeah, they didn't spend a ton of time
and,
on it.
And, you know, it is part of the show to have some cool action and want to see dragons in action.
Yeah, but the dragon parts were great. Yeah,
but
I
imagine in the writing process, somewhere between the screenplay and the editing, there were probably multiple different scenes of that battle meeting.
Mm.
And in the messenger coming, it seemed a little odd to have all that. They're having a meeting outdoors with all the men standing around about strategy.
Yeah.
And then Daemon shows up and the messenger shows up and then there was not even a scout that told them the messengers were coming. Like,
yeah.
It was all a little too staged.
They're skipping over a few things. Yeah.
Right.
Like some
and
of
it
the
was,
steps,
could have been
yeah.
like different scenes split up, but they
the episode is already 62 minutes long. And better to cut that out than cut out some of the hunt stuff, which was
yes,
so good.
Hunt,
we would
right.
not want
exactly.
to lose any of that.
Exactly.
That was a pleasant surprise. I really thought this episode was going to be like half.
I did too.
I was expecting that.
I did
that.
Too. But it was only like 10 minutes or something.
Yeah.
Maybe 15.
Really, yeah, I looked. It was about like 10-12 minutes, so it was a very short part of it.
Yeah.
So I'm okay with the sort of consolidating and semi-contrived nature, but they did convey a lot. In the end, like, it's just important to see that Daemon is willing to sacrifice himself. He's coming out of this a clear hero. He's not accepting his brother's help. You know,
he's dishonorable, too.
He's what?
Dishonorable.
Yeah, you attacking under the white flag. Yeah. I want him to be face repercussions for that, too.
Mm-hmm.
But I can get over too many arrows being shot, or he like.
Yeah, we've seen that before.
Another thing I guess that bothers me about it a little bit is that it makes the crab feeder a little less formidable of opponent when he could just like run through and kill 80 guys all by himself, and then like the crab feeder seems to be making a bad tactical decision too. Like it seems like he's anticipating dragons, but he keeps like, all right, more men, and it's not working, and he keeps doing it anyway. And then he finally runs away, and on his own home turf, Daemon is able to beat him. After
I think the
shot
implication.
Arrows,
well, I think like, the implication is that there's no one else in the caves. Like all his men are dead at that point. And himself, he's clearly not a fighter himself. He's covered in grayscale.
Yeah, he's a leader, but he wasn't leading very well.
I think he was leading well to that point
because
they were winning against dragons and all that. So,
but I still feel like all that's kind of nitpicking. The gist of the. You know, the plot points need to be hit, the development of the characters that need to happen all happen here. And there's lots of people who aren't thinking about the details of battle tactics.
Yeah.
It's just a great ride.
Cool. Enjoy the ride. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah.
Regarding crab feeder looking up at the sky for dragons, I kind of at the point that you see a dragon, it's probably too late to evacuate your men from the dragon
if they've committed too far. Yeah.
If you can see the dragon, it's too close. It's like one of those kind of things.
Yeah.
But. I feel that he was looking up thinking he would see Caraxes further because Caraxes is bright red.
Blends in with
the clouds and all that. And so, and
Damon there, you might be expecting Damon's dragon.
Yeah, you expect Damon's dragon to come out. And so he was able to get a little bit more like snuff up on. But I still feel like even if it had been Caraxes that showed up, he couldn't have possibly evacuated his men in time.
I came up with some other justifications, if you will, that like Daemon might not have just randomly showed up. He might have scouted out this spot, knew the route he was going to run, knew where the archers might be positioned and what angle he needed to be to avoid the arrow.
Yeah,
you know?
they're familiar with that position.
And this might not have been their home base. Like the crab feeder might have been chased to this island and they just ran in these caves. And
they made it clear that was their dug-in
that
spot.
That was their home base, mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was their dug-in spot.
But
anyway,
one way or the other.
Let's move on. So the other thing I want to draw attention to is I think they were maybe, if it wasn't on purpose, it was a lot of coincidence because this moment really shows Daemon channeling Achilles. Look at a standard of drawing of Achilles. He's got the horsehair helmet, very much like Daemon, black armor. Arrogant, unstoppable, except by arrows. That's the one thing that stops Achilles. Ultra proud, prone to sulking to the point of ridiculousness. Achilles just refuses to fight in the war anymore because he didn't, you know, because the king took his woman away. He's forged in flame. That's where his immunity comes from. And the Targaryens are all kind of forged in flame, you know, with their immunity. He's long-haired, extremely fast. That's something that, like, the Achilles parallel allows me to accept the arrow thing more because Achilles is so fast. He's like, well, he's just outrunning the arrows. It's said that Achilles has wings on his feet, which his dragon has. So cool.
Yeah.
The Trojan War took a really long time, like 10 years of siege. This has been a 3-year siege, so it's, you know, it's not quite as long, but it's still very long. Yeah, look at that. You could see that could be a scene from Troy. Achilles has long hair, just like that. Brad, I gave Brad Pitt that long hair and all that. Yeah. So crab feeder is no Hector, but we also have that beginning scene where he's yelling for him to come out and face him, which Achilles does to Hector from inside the walls of Troy. And then when he does kill Hector, he drags his body around, which also Achilles does. So just like tons of Achilles vibes here.
It's too much to be a coincidence. They were clearly drawing that parallel on purpose.
I think quite possibly, yeah. There's a chance they weren't. Ever since George said he doesn't do a lot of these parallels on purpose, I'm like backing off on my certainty on some of these. But anyway, it works really well, intentional or not, and it's very cool. I like that. That also helped me enjoy the battle more when I caught that. As with each additional parallel I discovered, I liked it even more. So, yeah, all right. Well, we have some final questions to talk about and a couple of callbacks, references, and small mentions that may start a small discussion here, but we're winding our way down here. Laura Brandos, one of our lovely mods in our Facebook group and friend of ours, all three of ours, sends a super chat. No question, but thank you, Laura. Much appreciated. Sandy Hartcorn also sends a super chat. Also, no question. Thank you, Sandy. Christina Kaido. I'm sorry, I don't know how to say your name, Christina. Christina K. She says, you know, I named her to protect the realm from Daemon. She was my only child. The realm's delight. I named her out of love because I no longer believed. That is a really good line. I guess, yeah, so we get the reference to the Realms of Light, which is in the books. And in this canon, it's...
If you remember last, on our Saturday episode, we speculated that we might get the referral of Rhaenyra as the Realms of Light. In this episode, we thought maybe a suitor or something might, but here we see that Viserys is referring to the fact that Rhaenyra was called the Realm's Delight since she was a baby.
Nice. Yes, indeed. So that is a really great line. Another powerful moment from one of many Viserys's great moments during of acting and characterization this episode. Christine, if you had any other thoughts on that quote that you wanted us to get to, let us know.
To be clear, Christina said they used the Realm's Delight, and then I grabbed the quote.
Oh, I see. Okay. I got you.
She did not grab the quote. I wanted us to have the full quote.
Cool. Well done. Dean Brown says, do you also think Viserys saw himself in the captured stag? That's what I was getting from his emotion.
That's what I got.
Maybe a little bit.
That is what I got from it. Personally.
He saw himself as trapped and held by his own, like his own people, holding him in place. Waiting to wait, just getting everything they can out of him, waiting him until they don't need him anymore. Yeah. Mm. Ooh, that's powerful. I didn't think of that. That's good.
You know, another thought on that, by the way, when he first stabbed the stag, he didn't quite get it. He had to do it a second time.
Yeah.
That's like the first Aerie named, and now he might have to name a second one.
Meanwhile, Rhaenyra killed her boar. Just stab, stab, got it right away.
Mm-hmm. She did have help.
Chris on Coles.
Yeah, he still helped. He got it down, but I mean, Viserys had help too, holding it down.
Viserys had a lot more help. You're right. Yeah.
A much better shot and a better weapon for the task, too.
Yeah. And the difference also being there's a dichotomy there is Viserys is hunting a defenseless animal, kills it with all this pomp and circumstance, whereas Rhaenyra is killing out of self-defense. It shows mercy to the White Hart when it does come around.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I wonder so much, like, if Rhaenyra had killed the White Hart, what that would have meant or signified to Viserys or anyone else. Mm. How that would have come across. Would it have further confirmed his prophecy? Would it have shown her to be the true heir? Like, how would they have interpreted that?
I think that's self-destructive. If you destroy the symbol that indicates you are the king or the queen, that you are the chosen one, you have destroyed the thing that
she ruined
makes
the
you
prophecy
that.
Or,
yeah, I think it's a stab at the thing that's elevating you.
It at least could be interpreted that way.
That's
and
one
anyone who didn't want her to be the lord of the land would like, interpret
see,
it that
yeah,
way.
See, yeah.
whereas if someone was trying to play up Rhaenyra, there's a number of angles.
She
that
was
could.
The white stag. Yeah, it went to her, not Viserys.
Yeah, exactly.
The blood of the stag is on her now.
Yeah, I feel like they could spin it a number of ways.
Or they could say, no, she proves she's unworthy, that she's, you know, refuses the crown in this sense. Yeah. So yeah, there would have been a lot of ways to interpret it.
Andrew Gilbert says, but the king was hunting it. And I say, yes, but the king was hunting it. So I think the king was meant to kill it, not some Rhaenyra or some other random person. Like, it might have been an offense if anyone else but Viserys had killed this hart.
That's true. Yeah, they would have said, that's his, not yours. Or which shows you how the interpretation is left up to what people want. Like, that's a big part of it, is how they want to interpret it, not how
he was hunting for the symbol, so it's okay for him to kill it. But it's a symbol of his son or his heir or whatever. Yeah. But again, it's still like the power of prophecy. Is that not the... I don't think that's the real power that you want. That's too tricky.
So there's a funny moment when they're having their battle plan and they're talking about how bad things are in the Stepstones. When they're like, we have 16 to 18 ships. And in that moment, those fire trebuchets are going off and one of the ships gets hit. And they could have said, okay, 15 to 17 ships. We just lost another one. One of the Stepstones islands is named Dwarfstone, which is not in canon, but we do know that some of the Stepstones aren't given names in canon. So for now, we'll just assume this is a workable name.
It's a good name for one of the Stepstones.
Yeah, it's a small one. Yeah, would be why it's not as prominent and given a name before. Yeah, there's a mention of the Golden Gallery, which is a famous location inside Casterly Rock. You can check out our Casterly Rock episode for more info on that, but it's a very fancy spot where there's just like thousands of years of Lannister sets of armor and weapons from all these famous Lannisters over the eons, and the amount of wealth just in that one room is probably absurd, and that's where he had the spear forged.
It's apparently almost like a museum that visitors to Casterly Rock are come through as they enter. Yeah,
good point. Yeah,
show off their prestige and wealth and everything.
Johanna Swan is mentioned as one of the captives taken by the excursions on the Stepstones. It's implied, not directly, that it's Crabfeeder himself or his men that do it. In canon, it's pretty much outright stated that's what happens, because the Crabfeeder and his men are start charging tolls for, because we cleaned up the pirates. We cleaned up the pirates. We deserve a toll for that. And then they start charging more and more and more. And eventually the Lyseni start taking boys and girls as part of their taxes. And they turn them into basically what Mazaria's life was, taken and turned into a sex slave. So that's what happened to Joanna Swan here. She's captured. She's of a famous marcher lord house, but her uncle refuses to pay the ransom. He's cheap. And she ends up becoming the Black Swan. She rises to become queen of in all but name, because she's such a badass and rises through the ranks. So that's cool.
Queen of what?
Queen in all but name of Volantis.
Okay.
It's either Volantis or Lys. I forget. One of the two. And there's also Kira Lannister and Lady Redwine, who we mentioned earlier. The line is, how have you served the realm, Lady Redwine? By eating cake? Right, and that's a great catch here. Rhaenyra just said she wished she could fly away and eat only cake. So, hey, she likes cake, too.
Yeah, it shows that she is weighted by responsibility, where she didn't want to be in this position, really, but she is, and it's been years since she's been able to just think about eating cake.
Mm-hmm. Otto has that great line that you mentioned, Sean. He says, I'm not one for signs and portents, but which signs and portents is the famous Targaryen book that Aegon the Conqueror's great-great-great-grandmother, Daenys the Dreamer, that's her book, signs and portents.
By the way, Joanna Swan, Lys.
It is Lys? Okay. Yeah, I couldn't remember if it was Lys or Volantis. Cool. Lys it is. There's also a mention by Lionel Strong, I believe, of how difficult Jaehaerys and Alysanne had it with their daughters. He kind of makes light of it. He's like, yeah, it's a family tradition for Targaryens to have trouble with their daughters. So he's like, look, you're not the first to have this problem. He's joking, but he's like, look, you're not alone in this. It's not like you have this unusual problem. It's like you screwed up uniquely, and all your other ancestors did this perfectly. So he's trying to like... It's another example of Lionel giving good counsel, not just good advice, but helping the king feel better, which helps him be a better king as well. Takes away a little of his difficulty there. So, as you mentioned earlier as well, Viserys just, he just picks the poo up without his glove, even though he wears gloves almost the entire episode. And I think it was Eliana of Girls Gone Canon, who made this joke on Twitter. Apologize if I'm misassigning the credit for this joke, but she said, no wonder he keeps getting infections. This guy just is not cautious with his just picking up stuff. But it's not as bad as Daemon. Just, you need to wear gloves too, Daemon, if you're going to be holding on to a dude with grayscale.
Yeah. I assume that that's not going to become a plot point. I feel like
I doubt it. They should have given him a glove, probably. That would have covered it. But whatever. Very tiny complaint. So Shay has on screen here some other Lannisters and Hightowers. We got Jason there and Tywin next to him.
But we can also see that Kira Lannister, who is likely married in from another house.
I believe that's probably their mother, and because Jason's father probably died, so that would have been her husband.
Yeah. Exactly. And then there's a man next to them, a guard of some sort. But he looks very Lannister.
Like, he does look fancy.
A cousin. He's got like the beard. He has like a kind of a book Tywin look.
You're right. He does have a book Tywin look. Maybe he's like, it could be a cousin or a brother, uncle. Not brother, but uncle.
But an uncle I could see. And then maybe Brett Lannister, the younger boy standing next to with the curls.
Mm-hmm.
That's
his name, Brett?
We knew he was cast ahead of time. And I recognized him. Yeah, the Jock Lannisters, as nobody suspects the butterfly, likes to refer to them. Because, you got your Jasons and your Jamies and your Bretts and your Kevins.
They're the most normal names, the most recognizable Earth names.
Yeah. so that's the Lannisters for you. And we also get a good shot at where is it here? Hobart and his wife.
Oh, what's her name? Do we know?
We don't know her name, but okay. I just wanted to highlight that we do get a little look at another Hightower.
Cool.
Basically.
So, two of the richest families. At this point, House Velaryon is the richest family, and it's unclear whether Lannister or Hightower they're next. These things go up and down. You know how it is with billionaires and trillionaires. Mm-hmm. Their fortunes move up and down based on other things. All right. We mentioned a few of our other episodes. Our Blackfyre series is pretty relevant for a lot of things. Shout out to our friend Christina Triptalon, who came up with some excellent Blackfyre club shirts, like the Hellfire Club. And shout out to our friend El Vallejos, who designed the logo for the shirts. Christina donated the logo to us, so we might be able to make it available for sale. We'll have to look into that.
Oh,
she gave it to us.
I didn't know that.
Last night.
We'll talk about that more. That's awesome. It's an awesome design. It was really fun. Like there was a big group of all of us, a bunch of people walking around with Blackfyre Club shirts. And we were like, oh, Hellfire. We're like, no.
Blackfyre. Yeah. See the B, the L, and the Y? It's
the
Hellfire
Club is from Stranger Things, the most recent season.
Right on. And Summer Hall episodes as well, we mentioned, as well as our Casterly Rock episode, referring to the Golden Gallery and some of Tywin's or Jason's claims about how great Casterly Rock is. We do get into that quite thoroughly, as well as our, this will be a final call for the Stepstones episode for now. We'll recommend that a few times, but since we're, for now, moving away from the Stepstones, this would be a good time. But the Triarchy is not defeated. Kragas Drehar was defeated, but the Triarchy has not been. So they may come back into the story. We'll see about that. Keep that in mind. Thanks to everyone for attending today. We really appreciate your attendance live. If you can't make it live, you can catch the replay on YouTube or on Spotify. We do have videos on Spotify these days. Or you can catch the podcast replay on Spotify or iTunes or Apple or Amazon Music. Anywhere you get podcasts, you can check us out there. Thanks for the support in that regard. You can also, of course, support us on Patreon or as a Spotify subscriber. And did you have any last thoughts, either of y'all?
I had a last thought. I realized we didn't address something that's been a big question from people I've seen on Twitter.
Okay.
I've seen in our YouTube comments. People keep wanting to ask, are Targaryens immune to grayscale? Could Daemon get grayscale from that? And a couple of thoughts there. One, mostly it seems like they are more immune than the average person, yes. But two, I don't think it's like an active infection that's spreading and he's dead and all that. I just don't think that that's going to be relevant.
Let's remember that grayscale was apparently created by Garen the Great, who created it specifically to target Valyrian dragon lords that had overrun the Rhoynar. So if it doesn't affect Valyrians, then it was a huge fail.
Yeah, so it must
but
affect
it's,
them.
I think the dichotomy here is the Targaryens have a heightened immunity to disease, but I think that's more towards natural diseases. I think magical diseases like grayscale and maybe the shivers, which maybe isn't magical, but maybe is because it killed baby Daenerys, is an
example. For example, there's theories about Sarah, Illyrio's Sarah, in the main series having Targaryen, Valyrian blood, right?
Particularly Blackfyre,
Blackfyre, to be clear, yes, but she died of grayscale.
She did.
So that is someone who could have Valyrian or Blackfyre or whatever blood who died of grayscale for sure.
And Illyrio kept her hands of stone. So that's.
But yeah, I think the greater thing is that I don't think Kragas had an active, like how if you have an infection, it could be like weeping or exposed, you know?
Yeah,
like
it was up on his upper body.
Yeah, you know, but I think that maybe also just being dead is enough to not transfer it at that point. I'm not sure.
Who knows? Either way, we'll see if it becomes a thing. But
also, how do you define disease or sickness or like Danny has diarrhea, right?
Eating
poorly, I guess, or bad water or something. I don't know exactly, but.
That's not a disease, more of just a.
Infection, bacteria, I don't know.
Reaction, I don't know. We're not doctors.
Pulled pork sandwich also brings up Maegel Targaryen.
Yeah, she died of grayscale, too. She worked with, she was a septa type who worked with the sick and it worked with people who had grayscale and then died of it. So yeah, that and she is full Targaryen. There's no, Sarah maybe had a different parent, who knows. But yeah, Maegel was the daughter of Jaehaerys and Alysanne. Yeah.
So yeah, right there. So that anyway. So yes, Daemon could have gotten grayscale, but I don't think he.
Despite those potentials, I just don't feel like it's what they're doing.
Yeah,
I don't feel like it's the direction.
It would be neat for him to lose two fingers like his brother,
especially because I don't even think they've said the word grayscale.
No, they never did.
We just know,
And on some level, they've got to make this show for people who didn't see and read everything else.
So that's true.
The fact they haven't even said it out loud, like
I guess. Yeah, my question about Crabfeeder also is. It's not clear to me whether the grayscale that he has is actively spreading or whether it's been stopped.
Oh, yeah, maybe he just, like Shireen, it was
Maybe he had been infected. Maybe it drove him insane, or he's in pain, but maybe he isn't dying next week from it. Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, that was my impression, was that, yeah, he wasn't actively dying from it like John Connington. It had been stopped, like Shireen. Okay,
maybe.
But
that's possible.
It had ransacked, it had ravaged his body.
Okay,
still,
yeah. That might make more sense, actually, than some ways. Yeah, that could fit. I could see that. But on that topic of them not pointing things out like that and just expecting us to understand, there's a good bit of that. A lot of these characters that have been introduced, like small mentions here and there, it's very subtle. They're not holding our hands. They're expecting us to pick up on things. They're looking at their audience as if we're high intelligence, and hopefully we are.
And also, like, I appreciate a show that assumes I'm going to watch it twice and talk to my friends about it. Like, I appreciate that there is enough, it's dense enough with information, clues, metaphor, on and on and on, that it makes it more worth rewatching and listening to a podcast about and talking to your friends about it. It creates a community. It has extra layers of depth and value to it with all that. So.
Right on. Yeah, definitely. And speaking of other podcasts, yeah, check out ones. I will be doing that. I'll be checking out some of our friends' podcasts and hearing their takes. You can join us on Saturday for...
We've got someone to promote coming up right after us, too.
Oh, yeah. Check out our friends Direwolf City. They are going on live every Monday right after us, around 8:30. So you can just switch right on over to them and get their takes instead. Alicia had a great take about Damon's immunity to arrows that reflects one of his ancestors. You want to check that out and hear her on that. That's a good one. But until next time, remember, Saturday at 3 is next time for our preview episode of Episode 4, which will be featured with Radio Westeros as our guests. Our good friends coming back after many years covering this stuff together. They're doing it on their own, so check them out in advance of that as well while you're at it, in addition to their other great content that's not House of the Dragon. But with that, we say goodbye. Valar re-read us, and as Sean just mentioned, Valar re-watch us as well.